Well, I'm Donna Dugan. I hope I've introduced myself to all of you individually. If not, I'll see you throughout the day. Thank you so much for coming and being part of our oral health expert panel. I'm going to turn it over to Heidi Bosley to introduce herself and welcome you from NQF, and we'll go ahead and get started.
Great. I don't want to say much other than thank you so much for flying to D.C. if you have, or driving here, you did come. We appreciate having you. We're excited to have you provide some input on this. It was not a small amount of work I know we asked you to do with those Excel spreadsheets, so we do appreciate it, and hopefully we'll walk out today with some recommendations.
Turn it over to you. Do you want to say anything? Or
just to say hello and welcome some familiar faces, some folks I haven't met. Hope to meet you all during this process. But, again, just to repeat the thanks for all the work that you put into looking at these. I know there were times where when I was going through it, my eyes would glaze over and think I saw something and rated it one way, and then another time thought I rated it a different way. And so I appreciate that challenge and the time you took.
And I'm Paul Glassman, also was asked by the staff to be co-chair of this group, which really means that we've had a couple of phone calls with the staff that you all haven't had. It doesn't mean much more than that. So we're going to be here with you participating in this as we go through the day today.
Okay. So what we would like to do is introductions, but along with that also disclosures. So I'm going to turn it over to Ann Hammersmith, our general counsel, to walk you through that.
Good morning, everyone. As Heidi said, I'm going to go through the disclosures of interest with you. I'm just going to make a few remarks, and then we'll go around the table. If you recall, several months ago, you received a disclosure of interest form from us, which you filled out, where we asked some very detailed questions. What we like to do at the first meeting of a committee is to go through the disclosures orally in the spirit of transparency, so everyone knows where everyone else is coming from. Just a few remarks and reminders about the oral disclosure. You don't need to be exhaustive. You do not need to recount your CV. We know you're all extremely qualified and smart, so there's no need to go through your entire resume. We are particularly interested in consulting, speaking, grants, or research that you have engaged in that is relevant to what's before this committee. I also want to remind you that you sit on the committee as an individual. Occasionally at these meetings, I'll hear a committee member say, "I am John Doe, and I'm here representing the interests of the American Society of fill in the blank." And you only represent yourselves. You sit as an individual. You're here because you are experts in the field. You don't represent the interests of anyone else, including your employer or anyone who may have nominated you to serve on this panel. The other thing that I want to remind you of is that I often hear people say, "I have no financial disclosures," or "I have no financial conflict of interest." Because of the nature of the work, whether you are paid or not doesn't tell the tale. You can have a real or apparent conflict of interest even if no money changed hands. For example, if you served on a committee where measures were discussed that are relevant to what's before this panel, usually those people don't wind up on the panel because we see it on their DOI form and they are excluded. But I just want to stress it's not strictly an exercise in financial conflict of interest. So what I'm going to ask is that we start with the chairs. If you can tell us who you are, who you're with, and if you have anything you'd like to disclose.
I'm David Kroll. I'm with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and I have no significant disclosures.
Paul Glassman. I work at the University of Pacific School of Dentistry in San Francisco. I'm a member of the board of directors of the DentaQuest Institute, which has sponsored some work around quality and is going to be doing some major initiative over the next several years related to quality activities. I'm also a member of the CHPRA Pediatric, get the name right, CHPRA Pediatric Quality Measures Program Dental Expert Panel. It's a long name. And finally, I just authored a report, which was released by the Kellogg Foundation and the DentaQuest Institute on oral health quality improvement in the era of accountability.
Hi, I'm Terry Batliner. I'm a faculty member at the Colorado School of Public Health. I'm also a consultant to the Kellogg Foundation on mid-level providers. I'm a PI for a early childhood caries clinical trial on the Northern Plains, as we say, Indian Reservation. We don't disclose what reservations we work on without tribal permission. I think those are my, I'm a private practice owner also.
Good morning. David Gesko from Health Partners in Minneapolis. And I speak with Institute of Oral Health. Otherwise, really no significant disclosures.
And hello, I'm Michael Helgeson with Apple Tree Dental, a nonprofit organization based in Minnesota, and I'm not aware of any conflicts of interest.
I'm Amy Hessel. I work at the MD Anderson Cancer Center as in the Department of Head and Neck Surgery, and I have no disclosures.
I'm Dick Hastrider. I am the dental director of 15 Blue Cross and Blue Shield states and the dental consultant for 3 Delta Dental states. I've been involved in developing proxy quality measures for 15 years, but I have no disclosures to make.
I'm Andy Snyder from the National Academy for State Health Policy, and I'll use my outside voice to be the microphone. For the
Could you use the microphone, please?
So I'm Andy Snyder with the National Academy for State Health Policy, and before coming back to NASHBI, I worked for the Pew Charitable Trust's Children's Dental Campaign, which included lobbying to state legislatures on issues related to kids' access to dental care. Part of that work included doing a report card that had measures related to state performance, not exactly the same thing as quality. My other significant disclosure is that I've been fighting a head cold all week, so if I don't shake your hand, it's not just because I'm not a nice person.
Good morning. I'm Diane Limbo. I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner. I work for Healthy Smiles for Kids of Orange County. The only disclosure I might make is I have 2 grants from HRSA currently that are to integrate oral health into practices, including a school-based health program.
Good morning. I'm Bob Russell. I represent the Association of State and Territorial Dental Directors. I'm also a consultant for DentaQuest Corporation on the disease elimination progress, and I'm also on the board of directors for the National Network of Oral Health Access, representing federally qualified health centers. Any other disclosure I could say, I'm also a member of the federally appointed advisory committee on training and primary care in dentistry, and we do look at quality measures, but none of the ones that we are currently looking at overlap what we're doing here.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Amit Acharya. I'm a dental informatics scientist at the Marshall Clinic in Wisconsin. Conflict of interest. I have a grant from HRQ that I'm a co-investigator on, working with the Kaiser Permanente group on developing diabetes registry. Then I also have a grant with NIDCR and a grant from Delta Dental of Wisconsin, especially working on integrating medicine and dentistry. I'm also the chair of the dental informatics section within the American Medical Informatics Association, and also the chair-elect at the dental informatics section at the American Dental Education Association.
Good morning. I'm Elspeth Calendarian. I'm the chair of Oral Health Policy Department at Harvard and the chief of quality at the Harvard Dental Center, which is all the clinics. I know all of my conflicts. I'll just tell them what I think are the conflicts. I am the co-chair of the quality group that we put together for 24 dental schools. I have an NIDCR grant that deals with electronic health records. I'm a co-investigator on a GO8 grant regarding data repository. We submitted an RO1 grant around patient safety. I work closely with Solution Leap on a lot of patient safety stuff. Just got a paper accepted around patient safety. I think that those are the main quality stuff thing that I do.
should just leave that out.
Sorry about that.
That's fine. Good morning. I'm Chris Smiley. I'm a general dentist practicing in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I'm so conflicted. Let's see. I serve as chair of the Dental Quality Alliance, which is a multi-stakeholder organization that many of you also participate in. I'm also a consultant for the code subcommittee for the ADA Council on Dental Benefit Programs. Other than that, I know of nothing else.
My name is Mary Ellis Lee. I work for a nonprofit research and advocacy group in New Haven, Connecticut. My work is in conducting independent performance monitoring in our Medicaid and CHIP programs, the Husky program in Connecticut. My work is almost entirely state-funded by the state of Connecticut. I do have some additional grant funding that supports some fee-for-service work. And that I also teach at the Yale School of Public Health.
Hi, I'm Jim Grawl. I'm chair of Public Health and Community Dentistry at UCLA School of Dentistry. Let's see. I am the child advocate for the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry, which means I'm a non-voting ex officio member of the Board of Trustees. I'm on the Dental Quality Alliance representing the Academy and Executive Committee, and I chair the Majors Research and Development Committee for the DQA. I am a member of the MetLife Dental Advisory Council, have been for some time, and they have quality initiatives on the commercial side. I'm a member of the DentaQuest Preventistry Advisory Group. I'm currently involved in a CHIPRA TA contract with Mathematica, and I've got a couple of, I'm involved in a couple of HRSA training grants as well.
All right, thank you everyone for making those disclosures. Do you have anything that you would like to discuss with each other or any questions for me based on the disclosures this morning? Okay. Just one last little reminder that you sit as individuals. And thanks for coming today, and have a good meeting.
Thanks, Anne. Can I ask the guests in the back to introduce yourselves?
Ralph Cuccillo with the DentaQuest Foundation and DentaQuest Institute.
Good morning. Renee Joskow, the new senior advisor for oral health at HRSA, a.k.a. chief dental officer.
Krishna Vamadhan, American Dental Association and Dental Quality Alliance.
And we missed one important person, Kristen, who you all must probably have heard from.
Hi there. Welcome.
Can I make sure just to remind everyone to use your microphones when speaking? We're recording the meeting for a transcript for notes, so just make sure you hit the speak button when you are speaking. Can I ask Anthony on the line if anyone anyone's dialed in?
We have no participants dialing in at this time.
Okay, thank you. In terms of restrooms, actually just go right back out straight through the door past the elevators, on, and they're on the right-hand side there. There is breakfast in the back if anyone missed that. And then hard copies of materials are right here on the shelf. I'm not sure if anyone missed those, but we can get those to you. Are there any questions or comments before we go ahead and get started on the agenda? All right. So we'll just go ahead and move right on to the project overview, meeting goals, and review of the agenda. You should have a copy of the slides. They were over there on the side, and we'll just work our way through those. I just wanted to review with you to start off the tasks for this project. We're to do an environmental scan of oral health measures, measure developers. That includes measures in that are concepts, measures in use, and then various characteristics of those measures, which we have completed, a catalog of oral health priority areas from HHS, HRSA, and Healthy People 2020, which we've also completed, and then a mapping of those measures to those priority areas. We were to convene an expert panel, which we have, and then use the expert panel to help us with the following. Prioritize measure concepts within the priority areas. Identify any remaining gaps within those priority areas. Identify any additional concepts to help fill those gaps, if available. And then we'll prepare a report based on your recommendations and post those that report for public comment. In terms of a timeline, so a few of these we've already completed, as I mentioned, the scan, the expert panel, the catalog of priorities. Today we'll be working on prioritizing measures, identifying gaps, and making recommendations. We will work on producing a report in the month of April based on your recommendations, and we may be in contact with you to review some of the recommendations or the report prior to it going to public comment, which will happen in May. Most likely any review we have you do would be offline. It would be a review of the report and then for you to provide any comments to us. So we may reach out to you for that in the month of April. Then the report will go up for public comment on the NQF website for a month. We'll receive comments about the report, and then we'll contact you about helping us reconcile some of those comments to edit the report if we need to do so, and then the report will be released in July. So it's a pretty quick project, six-month turnaround, and we're feeling that, and I'm sure you are too with our requests for your activities moving along. But again, we very much appreciate your active participation. So we were asked some questions about, you know, what's the project's purpose and the value add? As you know, there are many things going on in terms of quality measurement for oral health. So what are we trying to do here? Well, we know there's lots of measures, and you know that very well from your own work, but also in the environmental scan, you saw over 250 measures. So there are lots and lots of oral health measures, which I think surprised a lot of people. When we started off on this project, we weren't expecting to find so many. And a lot of them are redundant or variations on a theme, but there are a lot of measures. But the issue is they're not standardized. And that, I think that's the biggest issue, is we don't have standardized oral health measures across the board. And I know HHS is looking for standardized measures to be used for providers, programs, plans, and populations. So we want to build on existing work. We're not starting from scratch. We know there have been previous projects, and we're trying to work from those projects moving forward. There are also parallel projects going on as we speak. But right now there are only four NQF-endorsed oral health measures. And if at the back of the slide set, just for your reminder, there are the four listed there, just so you know which four oral health measures have already been NQF-endorsed. So they meet all of the NQF criteria. They were also in your environmental scan as well, but that's for your reference. So given there's so many measures and they're not necessarily standardized, we want to figure out what the environment, the total environment of oral health measurement looks like in terms of quality and quantity of measures, and that's what we're doing in this project. And then in terms of all of those measures, since there are over 250, which ones are important? Which ones are the most important concepts to measure? So if we want to go somewhere first, where should we be going? Which measures are important in terms of evidence, in terms of a quality gap, in terms of feasibility? And then once we start with those, are we missing anything? Are there major gaps? To improve quality of care, we want to obviously fill those gaps. So we need your help in determining if there are any gaps that we can currently fill. So what's next? Well, talked about the actual next steps in this project being the report going out for public comment, but the goal and the hope with this project is this may be first of a few projects for NQF and oral health, but we really want to move the field towards additional development, testing, endorsement of important, feasible, standardized measures. So what we'll be doing today? The goals for today are to help prioritize measure concepts within priority areas. And let me clarify, the work that you did offline in terms of prioritization was more at the measure level. And we heard feedback from quite a few people to take your ratings with a grain of salt. And I understand that given the breadth of measures, how many measures there were across how many priority areas, and they were repeating. And you'll see, as evidenced by that, when you look at the rating summaries, that the numbers really range from maybe 1.5 to about 3. And there's not a lot of difference. So we understood that, and we took a look at that, and Paul emphasized that with us, and that's why he created the concept table, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. So the ratings in that spreadsheet are not going to be the major focus today. That'll be one piece of the larger picture. But we needed you to do that for us to understand really where we were and where we wanted to go. So we appreciate that. So we want to not only prioritize concepts, major concepts within the priority areas, but then identify remaining gaps and any additional concepts to fill those gaps. So those are the goals for today. And as we walk through the agenda, we'll be more specific about tasks for the committee and what we really want you to discuss. So let's review the agenda at a high level right now, and then when we get to each item at the appropriate time, we'll talk to you again about what we would like the committee to specifically discuss. So the next item after this overview will be the state of oral health performance measurement, a discussion of environmental scan results. This item is really to get you the conversation started about your impressions of the state of oral health performance measurement, as informed by what you saw in the scan, but also from your own experience. What does it look like out there? We just talked about it not being standardized, but what are you really seeing? Is it mostly process measures? Is it mostly child measures? That type of discussion. Then we'll move on to the meat of the day, and each of the next agenda items are really about using the priority areas from the scan and talking about the measure concepts within each priority area. And we'll work our way through all priority areas, A through J, throughout the day, receiving your recommendations on priority concepts. And then once we've worked our way through those, we'll try to do a summary of recommendations. We'll be taking real-time notes here. And we'll open it up a few times during the day for member and public comment, if anyone's on the phone or any of our guests would like to comment. And we'll review next steps one more time and then adjourn. So any comments or questions from the group before we go ahead and get started on our first discussion item?
One of the sort of challenges I thought in terms of jumping in and rating the measures was really try to get a grasp of the intended users or the focus for this. When you say safety net providers, Medicaid, Medicare, others, you really start covering some waterfront. And in terms of the short time frame, the project, I really sort of think it's useful to try to understand if there's going to be an effort to try to segment, the thinking or the recommendations around some of those kinds of categories, or whether we just sort of still try to deal with this in some big global, sort of piece of work.
Yeah, I can try to address that. Maybe Heidi or Renee could actually also respond from her side. I think initially, and when talking with our HHS representatives, they're really looking for measures across the board for Medicaid, for Medicare, for HRSA's special populations. There are a number of HHS agencies really looking for standardized measures. So I think, the first goal is to talk about the universe, what's out there and what's important. And our project's a pretty short time frame. Those discussions can be very lengthy in terms of taking a concept and then changing the concept or the specific measure and creating it for a specific population. That takes a long time. Those are measure development activities. I think right now we're looking for what are the important concepts that you could use possibly across the different types of programs, and then as the measures get developed or tested later on, they would then be framed for those special populations or that special program. So I think it's right now we're at a higher level and we're talking about what's important in general.
Yeah, and I think, at the concept level, sort of a reasonable way. Where it gets to be important, though, is when you start getting into the sort of the nitty-gritty of some of the measures and what are the mechanisms for data collection, which could vary considerably across those different sort of categories.
And I think when we start talking about the concepts, and we'll ask you, we'll be talking about important concepts, but then there'll be time when, any panel member, knowing the measures that were in the scan, given there's limited information about data elements or denominators, anything from the scan, but if there are concepts or measures you saw in the scan that you think would be appropriate for a specific type of population, or it would be okay to mention that. Like when we're talking about a concept, this is an important concept, and I saw this measure in the scan, and maybe you know about it more personally. Maybe you've used the measure. You might say this is an important measure. I think this I would recommend this measure be used because, but we may not be able to say that at all because of the limited information in the scan. So I think we're starting at the high level. If we have any more detailed information and you'd like to contribute that, please do so. Please do so. Any other comments or questions? No? Okay. So if we want to go ahead and get started on the 9:15 agenda item here, state of oral health performance measurement, just to tee this up. Again, we're looking here for a sort of descriptive characteristic. So what is your impression in general of the state of performance measurement for oral health care based on what you saw in the scan or based on your own knowledge in terms of quantity and quality of measures, most measures being for pediatrics, how are they mostly at the concept level or are they specified? So I'm just giving you examples of what types of discussion items we're looking for here. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, maybe I'll jump in and just give my 2 cents worth on that question, which is I did have the opportunity to sort of dig into this question extensively over the last year because of this report that I did for the Kellogg Foundation and the DentaQuest Institute, and some of you, I think, may have seen it. And my impression after spending quite a bit of time reviewing literature, talking to a lot of people, including many who are in the room, is number one, there's a lot of measures out there, which I think we've just been through an exercise. Everyone fully recognizes that now, having waded through that extensive spreadsheet. There's a lot of measures out there. Many of them are redundant, and as you saw, and overlapping. But still, even without that, there's still a lot of measures that are out there. The problem with the current state of measurement of quality in oral health is that the measures are often not well defined. They tend to be performance measures that tend towards sort of the lower level. If you had a sort of a pyramid of measuring procedures, those are the most rigorously used and defined measures. If you look up at population health, those are much less widely in use. Measures tend not to be tied to performance. So most of the measures, particularly the higher level ones looking at population health, tend to be used for informational purposes. So somebody, government agency or other people, collect measures and they produce reports, say this is what we found, that there's, you know, 3 to 5 year olds with brown hair have this much caries by our definition, whatever it is, and so put it out there hoping that someone will do something about it. But it's not, there are very few examples of measures actually being tied to performance, particularly financial performance, particularly incentives that would have somebody do something different, which I think is the goal ultimately of having performance measures, is you'd want people to use them in quality improvement programs where they would be used to drive performance in a direction. So there's very little of that. And then I also agree with, I think, the point that you were making, Jim, which is that many measures don't really specify who the target is for the measure. And I think that it's important to do that, and I think that anyone who's doing measures needs to have that as a part of it, because if the target is to look at the performance of a Medicaid program in a state, I think that's pretty different than looking at the performance of a provider or looking at the health of low-income kids in a school district. So I think that that's typically left off of measurement concepts, and I believe it should be. So that's my sense of where we are with the state of measurement.
Just a response to your last point in terms of when the measures come in for NQF endorsement, there is part of the submission form does ask for that as a piece of information, which is who is the measure created for, what population is it appropriate for, and then the testing information should represent that it was tested in that type of population or for that specific population. So we need to get there, but we aren't right now.
Just one other brief comment was, you know, I agree with what Paul kind of mentioned, and a general pattern was there's not much of diagnostic information being embedded in any of these, and for a very well-known problem in dentistry that we do not have a standardized diagnostic set. I mean, there are several organizations.
We have one.
Yeah, it needs to be. What I was trying to make the point was we need to have a standardized where then we could talk about, you know, whether is it ICD-9s or is it Snow-Dent or Elsbeth's Easy Codes. So there are a lot of diagnostic codes out there, maybe kind of trying to develop these measures in including some of those concepts. Diagnostic concept would be really, really necessary, because right now we might be saying measuring based on a performance, you know, or a procedure versus, you know, what was the actual diagnostic problem that existed. So that's a big, big gap right now, I think.
I think there's a real point to that, and I've had an opportunity to work at the Marshfield Medical Foundation on medical research, and I had seven nurses who worked for me who actually abstracted medical records. And the reason they abstracted the medical records was because they didn't believe the physician's diagnostic coding. So I think the diagnostic coding brought to dentistry would be great, but it isn't the gold standard.
Yeah, I would say, you know, using Donna's examples, that, you know, most of the things that people consider to be measures that are used in a pretty broad sense are focused on children and around what I'd call use of services. And the one other example that I sort of think we ought to have on the table is, at least in the adult side, you know, the Department of Defense did invest in developing a CAHPS survey for dental care. I personally worked with some folks at RAND on the development of a pediatric module that's based on the CAHPS sort of framework, and it's been used by the Healthy Families, the CHIP program in California for a number of years. But and I know that, you know, in the measures that we were asked to rate, there were sort of individual items, but I think that those, you know, consumer assessment surveys are an important element that do need to be considered, and at least on the adult side, there has been some investment in doing that as well.
I work in kind of two different worlds, and in Native populations, clearly I see issues with access, and there were some access measures for the underserved, you know, primarily groups that I saw. But then as a private practice person, you know, the issue of over-treatment is something that you see all the time with people who flow through. And so if you do a great crown on a tooth that didn't need a crown, is that good quality? I don't think so. So how... I mean, I think this is one of our big challenges, and I think it goes to the issue of lack of diagnostic codes. How can we examine appropriate treatment based on the, you know, the actual need of the person?
Yeah, and that actually leads to the next thing is there were no measures on patient safety, which is one of my big pet peeves, which I think is really important. Medicine has really done, I think, a good job in measuring outpatient safety. And I think it's really, really important for us to add that in that. And I agree, these measures were very static and look back, and we really need to make them quality improvement measures.
Or, Michael, why don't you go first? You were in the queue before. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just I think it's interesting, you know, that these are framed in terms of measures that are of use to government agencies. And I'm not opposed to that. That's what we're trying to improve, but I think, you know, the issue of quality and oral health is one that's a population issue. And I think I like the Institute of Medicine framework around quality. Safety is first, effectiveness is second, does whatever it is work, patient-centered, to what degree does the health intervention respect and collaborate with the patient. And they're an active player in evaluating whether they were happy with it or not. So patient-centered, timely. Now that gets at some of the access measures. Do people get the care at the right time, the right frequency, that sort of thing. Efficiency is something that I think we overrate, to be honest with you. A lot of the measures that are in here, my opinion is most of them relate to what I would call efficiency. And efficiency is how rapidly are you delivering the things that you've been delivering for the last 20 or 30 years. But you may be rapidly delivering the wrong stuff. You know, you might be getting too many things to the wrong people and not, you know, whatever. So I think if you have measures of efficiency and you lack diagnostic information, and you lack effectiveness measures, you're really not measuring anything that's meaningful, in my opinion, in terms of actual health improvement, which is really what the whole endeavor is all about. And then equity is the final IOM category. You know, are these health services being available on an equitable basis to various population groups and categories and so on? So I guess my sense is I like those six IOM categories. To me, they frame quite nicely just as both a provider and a consumer of healthcare. You know, those are sort of the six things I would be looking for. So I would hope that we would, you know, not get totally tracked into just looking at existing measures, which I think, for the reasons that have been cited by everyone else, really are not very good. I'm not impressed. You know, nobody can tell me, for example, what the right utilization rate is. There is no answer to that. And the reason there's no answer is because you would need to know the diagnoses and you would need to know the effectiveness of the interventions and how frequently they needed to be applied in order to say what the correct utilization rate is. So utilization rate in today's environment doesn't really tell you anything about quality other than that activity is happening. You know, it tells you that activity is happening and how much, but it doesn't tell you whether the activity is improving health.
And I respect also, you know, something that Paul touched upon as far as measurement as a economic tool, as a cost containment tool. However, I think when we identify gaps and we take a look at, you know, evolving recommendations for future measurement, I think it's important that we look at those measures that advance the health of the population that's being served, the oral health of the population that's being served. And we're handicapped in a lot of ways because there is such a dearth of evidence-based clinical guidelines or recommendations. But I think that we have to take a look at what those guidelines are that are out there and base, hopefully, recommendations towards that with a goal towards improving overall oral health for the population.
I think you raised a very good point. Measures should never be used for cost containment. And as you know, I am heavily into both the commercial and the government program side of measurements. And if insurance companies or Medicaid programs or SCHIP programs are using measurements for that purpose, it's totally inappropriate and could definitely lead to the detriment of the oral health of the people being served.
Dick, how do you square what you said with the triple aim, where you're simultaneously advancing the health, the experience, and the affordability of a population? Am I missing something there? Because I would come at it differently and say that measures can absolutely be used to measure affordability and efficiency in the delivery of care.
Oh, I agree with that. But what I'm talking about is that there are some, especially commercially insured insurance products, that use measurements not to determine efficiency or appropriateness of care based on current research and scientific evidence and the epidemiology of the population being served. They use it merely to keep the costs down so that the loss ratio in the program is quite opportune for the company as opposed to the patients and the providers.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think, you know, the efficiency sort of label from an economic standpoint is fairly commonly used, but I think a lot more people now are talking about value, which relates the cost to the outcome of the care. And I think that's a way to use the sort of the economic side of things, but to also get to the issue about is it really making a difference?
Well, I think Jim's right. That's exactly what we're using measurements for.
So just one more comment on that point. I think what we're coming around to here is the idea that it's appropriate to use measures related to cost, but If you're just trying to save money, you're not concerned about the health of the population, that might not be appropriate. But I think it is clearly in the interest, and one of the primary goals behind doing measurement at all is to make sure we're spending our scarce resources wisely, so that that does involve measuring things and looking at what's being done and the outcomes of it. So I think there's a direct relationship between measurement and cost, but in an appropriate manner. And just one other comment about something that got said earlier was I think we're struggling with, I think you just said it, Chris, the fact that we don't have very many evidence-based standards of care in the dental world. And so the question about did you do that crown, was that the right thing to do, it's often very hard to answer that question because you'd want to answer that based on some sort of evidence-based standards of care. And in many cases, we don't have anything that could actually point to and say, yes, you should have done that crown or you shouldn't have. And then if you don't have that to start with, it's hard to – and not that we don't have any of those. There's many things that are done in the dental world that we don't really have a way of saying this was the right thing to do or it wasn't the right thing to do.
I just wanted to echo some of the comments related to pitfalls related to doing financial analysis related to healthcare and maybe just emphasize the point that the efficiency in terms of providing a unit of service for a lower cost is usually the way it's measured today. Whether it's on a fee-for-service model where, you know, if you can deliver more fill-in-the-blank crowns at a lower cost, then that's economically the traditional analysis is, well, that's a better value. Or on the health plan side, if you can deliver a package of services at a lower per member per month cost, then that's – but those things aren't really measuring a meaningful health outcome at all, and that gets at this value that Paul – described in his paper, I thought, you know, quite well, that we need to move to determining what value actually is. And once we've figured out what that actually is, then set up some measures that relate to it. And I think what we're trapped in right now is that the tools and the measures we have are not actually measuring value. We don't have benchmarks. And so if we codify them, my concern is that we will do what Dr. Hastrider suggested would be wrong, which is we will end up squeezing out what good quality there is in the interest of driving down costs and, you know, throwing out the baby with the bathwater, basically.
I would disagree a little bit. I think Michael Potter and Tom Lee have very well defined how to define value, and it's the elimination of disease and morbidity and ultimately mortality. And actually, I took their model and created a dental model for that. So I think there's the beginning of that, and I think we can take that and learn from that. So I think there's something out there. There's a lot for us to do. But I do agree with you. It's not about on the treatment end. It's about elimination of disease in the diagnostic end. I totally agree.
I just wanted to add a few things from the NQF perspective, and I've listened to all this, so a couple things kind of listed together. But wanted to emphasize that today, even though this is HHS-funded work, NQF always looks for measures that are as broad as possible. So I think as you look at what you have here and you come up with the concepts that you would prioritize, if there are things that you think would may be unique to a given population, let's definitely capture it. But ideally, we're looking for measures that go broad across the populations, across providers, across settings. So the more we can do that, the more actually other individuals can take those measures and use them as well. So really would love you to do that. If you think there's something we need to target, though, please we'll want to capture that. The other thing is we have work on efficiency that I think we haven't provided to any of you, looking at the cost component as well as the quality component. And we've started endorsing measures that are looking at relative resource use and cost. Oral health is obviously not one of the areas that we've seen anything come in yet. But we've emphasized that that's a building block, that you want those cost measures paired with the quality. One without the other doesn't set the context that you really want when you're looking at efficiency. So I think as you discuss it, it's probably worthwhile to talk about, are there resource use or cost measures that perhaps could be built in the future? What would those look like? And then, you know, as that gets built out, we'll start looking at in the future, how would you then mirror that and merge that together with the quality measures. And then I had one other thing, and now I've forgotten it. Oh, evidence, yes. I knew Donna would remember. So the other thing is we actually, not only do we want to capture what gaps there are in measures, but if there's gaps in evidence, I think that's equally important to capture in your discussion today. Because part of what we will do is try to show where you think you can head with measurement now, where you think that the evidence yet doesn't yet exist, but you want to encourage others to perhaps support and focus on, and I think that's an important thing for us to do. HHS has asked us to do that in a lot of our projects. I think this is a good one to focus that on as well.
Just one other thought I had was as I was looking through, you know, some of the referral measures, you know, obviously all of us know here that oral health is so intricately connected with our systemic health. I just saw probably one measure talking about pregnant women coming in during the pregnancy for a dental, some kind of a dental procedure, but there's nothing about diabetics or cardiovascular disease patients where there is a necessary oral screening or some kind of a periodontal scaling, at least for diabetic patients. Now, there are guidelines out there, especially if you look at the American Diabetes Association guidelines on a dental patient, a diabetic patient needs to have at least a six-month dental visit, some kind of an oral screening if they're dentulous, or, you know, 12-month if they're edentulous. So those are some of the things that, you know, there is a strong gap right now. We need to be also looking at some of the systemic health side of things and how that relates to the oral health.
So keep that in mind as we get into these different organizations. We'll come back to that. Hopefully we'll bring that back up when we get into the concepts and things like that and the gaps that we have.
Let me make a comment about that. Go ahead. I also want to comment about that point as well, because we're going to get into this as we move through the rest of the day. And I think one of the things we're going to wrestle with today is the issue of sort of concepts versus stratification. So if you want to measure some kind of frequency of visits, you know, is the best and most useful way to do that to come up with how do you measure visits? What does that mean? Or you want to measure caries? What does that mean? Versus stratification. Do you want to measure caries in 2.5-year-olds with brown hair, and then you can have 47 different measures of where you use the concept of caries to measure it in different populations. So, for instance, visits, you could measure that in people with diabetes. You measure it in pregnant women. You can measure it in a lot of different. You could stratify the data in a lot of different ways. You might want to have a sort of standardized measure of what a visit is or what a service is or service utilization. And so I think we're going to wrestle with that as we go through the day, is the idea of, so what's the big concept, what's the stratification of how you might use it in different populations or different ways.
So I have Richard, Amy, and David.
There are methods of synthesizing the epidemiology of oral disease in a population and using measurements to come to some conclusion about what is going on in that population relative to their oral disease, and then using proxy variables to translate that information into cost effectiveness in terms of the oral disease condition of individual patients and populations of patients. I mean, it can be done. It's not as clean as we'd like, but there are ways to do this. And I have never seen it done. We've been working on it for 15 years, and it's not perfect, but it's pretty good because our in-office audits and surveys are consistent with the results we get with statistical and mathematical analysis.
One of the things that's been very helpful in identifying metrics for cancer patients in general is to create guidelines on the treatment of those patient populations and then looking at the stepwise process through a treatment and deciding which level in the algorithm that has a decision-making point that then affects prognosis or care. And so, of course, I don't really know the dental process, but perhaps if there's guidelines on these different patient populations on appropriate access to care and then the appropriate workup and the appropriate you know, offering treatments or whatever, I don't know. But if we can go back to an algorithm and say, yeah, this is how this patient population should be treated, and then at that point you look at which, at what level can you find a branch point that affects, you know, prognosis, good care, whatever, and then can say, is there a metric that identifies that? And it's just, it was easier to step back to the algorithm to find the metrics than to just randomly say, well, if you survived cancer, then you had good care. You know, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. And so, but again, I don't, because I, when we were looking through this very large Excel spreadsheet, I just felt, I got overwhelmed by the multitude of similar metrics coming through for very small populations, and it seemed like that there probably has to be some generalized algorithm of care for that whole population that then we could then stratify down to a very nice broad metric that would fit for this process. But again, I don't know. So.
My comments, I think, build very nicely on what Amy said and speak to those kind of processes. In the group that I come from, the way we define evidence-based care is the fact, and it's not an exclusive definition, is that we have guidelines that we create, and we have those guidelines that are available in the public domain at guideline.gov for caries, periodontal treatment, et cetera. And then what we measure in our practice is that those guidelines have with them risk assessment tools for caries, for periodontal disease, for oral cancer. And then the measurement that we do is, are you, first of all, doing a risk assessment on all patients? And then are you doing interventions that are proven to mitigate those risks? And if you are, we use that presently as a surrogate measure of quality. And, you know, we could debate that, whether that's valid or not. But there were measures in the analysis that we did that were similar, that talked about things that you do relative to a risk assessment. And so I guess I'm speaking in favor of looking at those measures as ones that pull a lot of these things together. And then because some of us have talked about the specific populations, diabetics, cardiovascular disease, et cetera. Those things are a part of a risk assessment. When you do a risk assessment, in my opinion, those things are touched upon, and then that contributes to a patient's risk, and then that contributes to a treatment plan based on that evidence. And so in some ways, we're a long ways away from having things, and in other ways, I think we're pretty close. I mean, we've got some good building blocks.
I just wanted to say that with respect to looking at people with other medical conditions for whom oral health is a really key component of their treatment, pregnant women and those with diabetes and cardiovascular disease, I think that speaks to being able to link claims data sets across oral health care systems and medical systems. And most of the measures that we looked at were based solely on oral health, on dental claims, those that were claims-based. And I think that we won't get a total picture of the quality of care of some of these people with other diseases unless we do that. And the one other area I would mention with respect to that is injuries. I didn't see any measures in here that had anything to do with dental injuries and with and where you can use emergency department records and there is a diagnosis and there's a secondary diagnosis with nature of the external cause of injury. I think there's a wealth of information about how to improve oral health in general and to what extent the treatment's being given in non-dental sites like the emergency room.
Yeah, I actually wanted to follow up on Dick's comment, but it's got the same theme, I think, that Mary Alice had. I don't know the details, but the folks at CDC, at least, are starting to work on linking epidemiologic data coming out of NHANES with utilization data. And I think that, you know, that's what Dick's saying. You know, it's not going to be a perfect world, but And of course, there's always limitations about sample size and sensitivity about how far you can generalize with some of those survey type of data. But at least at a concept level, for articulating that, I think that and identifying processes by which that can be done, you know, that at least would allow, if it can't be done at a national level, or maybe it can be done at a national level, but then you can't extrapolate that, you know, maybe states will want to sort of pick up on that approach. The other thing that comes into play, though, when I think when you start looking at some of those kind of things, is the issue about the variability and differences you see depending on the source of the data. You know, data that comes out of MEPS or places like that that actually have some verification process vis-a-vis telephone surveys historically have yielded some pretty different results. And I think that, you know, so that mechanism, though, I think is important, and it goes back to that value piece that we were talking about earlier. But the data source and understanding the validity and reliability of those data sources, I think, is going to be important going forward.
And just one bit further about what you just said, Jim, was I think that the data sources actually are important to consider when you're talking about the measure. Because, if, for example, if you're talking about a measurement of trying to come up with some kind of standard measurement of dental caries, you might have a pretty different measurement if you're talking about doing that based on some kind of a screening examination versus a full examination in a dental office with x-rays. So the source of the data actually does impact the measure as well.
Okay, thank you very much for your feedback on this first item. I think we're going to go ahead and move to our next agenda item and start talking about your recommendations for the priority areas. So for these next agenda items, you'll need three different documents. We'll be using this slide as a guide for the discussion. It's in your slide set, but it'll also be here up on the screen. That's the concepts, prioritization, and gap analysis will be used to guide the discussion. You'll also want to have in front of you the oral health concept areas document. This is the document that Paul Glassman helped us put together. And then you'll want the infamous measure workbook in front of you as well. So again, the measure workbook is what you're very familiar with. The only difference is it now has an average rating column, which was calculated as an average of all 16 panel members' ratings for each measure. Again, you'll see that the ratings are pretty much from about 1.5 to 3. There's not a ton of variation, and we know it was a difficult exercise. Again, we heard take our ratings with a grain of salt. So given that, I think it's still important to have that piece of information here in front of you, and also to have the measures that we did go through, have that in front of you as well. So we'll be using that workbook. We'll be using Paul's concept sheet and this slide for the discussion. So I will turn it over first to Paul for him to review with you how he came up with this concept sheet, and then I'll discuss exactly the discussion points we'll want the committee to consider as we go through each priority area.
I would say that I came up with this really out of just frustration at the task. So, and I'm sure you all experienced some version of that, it became very clear early on that it was going to be impossible. Although I did it, and I thank all of you for doing it as well. But, I had, first of all, attention deficit very early on, which meant it was just hard to concentrate on the 47th measure of caries, you know, again, in the three-year-olds with brown hair and blue eyes. That was one thing. And second of all, it began to be apparent to me that we were talking about something I mentioned a few minutes ago. We're talking about really two different things, maybe more, but at least two different main concepts. One was what the actual concept is that's being measured. So dental caries, as opposed to dental caries in three-year-olds and dental caries in five-year-olds and people with caries and people without caries, really the issue, the overriding concept was is there a standardized measure that could be used for dental caries, and if there is, then for various purposes, people could use that measure in various ways. So I just really started at the beginning, just for my own sanity, to try and keep track of what what I thought the big picture measures were, and it turned into a spreadsheet, and we had some conversations with the staff over the phone and decided to try and use that for the work today, because it just seemed very difficult to do what came out in the measurement analysis. I also just did a little this is my obsessive-compulsive disorder coming out here, but I looked at the standard deviation on our ratings, and the standard deviation is about as high as the variability. So, so it showed that we were all over the place. Not only was it hard to do, but we were all over the place. We weren't well calibrated, and so I think that we're really the numbers themselves are really clearly not going to be that useful. So with that in mind, I tried to look at the at what I thought were the bigger picture concepts, came up with something. It had about 30 items in it, but it's now been expanded up to 101, partly because because the staff took some of them, and they're now repeated so that they fit within the healthy people priority areas. So some of them you'll see come out multiple times, although I didn't originally have it that way. So what we discussed in a phone call prior to today is that we would work off of this sheet with the one that Donna just referred to, and we would talk about the within the healthy people priority areas, we would look at the sort of the bigger picture concepts, and as the example, the first one there under priority area.
Just so you're oriented, make sure you have the right one. It says oral health concept areas in the upper left-hand corner, small print. And you'll see priority area A on there. So it's not the there's two that you might be confused with, but that's up in the left-hand upper left-hand corner. It should say oral health concept areas. No, it's not part of the giant metallic clip section.
Though you'll want to have the clip handy because it has the measure, the detailed measures in it as well, which we'll want to refer to.
So, for example, we'll both use an example of a suggestion how we're going to move forward, and also as the first item to talk about is this first priority area under healthy people, which is oral health of children and adults, and OH1 is reduced proportion of children and adults with dental caries experience in their primary or permanent teeth. Again, my idea was that the concept here is dental caries. What's the measure of dental caries? And in looking through all the various measures there, it seemed that there was really two different ways that dental caries was being addressed in all the other measures that mentioned caries. One was caries based on a screening examination and caries based on a full examination with radiographs. And so I listed those as the two concepts that came out of OH1 is dental caries, measure dental caries with based on screening examinations or surveillance, and then measure caries based on full dental examination with radiographs. I also tried to do, this is just my own guess, there's nothing set in stone about it, is to list potential sources for that kind of data and potential targets for that data. So as you can see, I thought if you were looking at based on surveillance, where you have a chance then of getting at the whole population, you can measure population of caries, you can measure a particular program like a Medicaid program in a state. You could also look at issues related to provider performance, and you could also look at patient characteristics. Whereas if you're looking at measures of caries based on a full examination and radiographs, then you're probably now looking more at something that would be based on a review of dental records, which, again, limits the population of people who have actually gone into a dental office and had a full examination with radiographs. And that also limits the potential target. You're looking then probably at providers and patients, because it's not going to be a whole population kind of measure if that's the way you're measuring it. So I think maybe we should just stop there and start look at that particular one, OH1, and see what people's thoughts and comments are about looking at it that way.
Jim? Paul, actually just a question. So in your use of the terms surveillance, would that include a telephone survey?
Well, I think that the idea that I had here was that these things need some definition. I wasn't trying to do that work.
Yeah, no, but I'm just trying to figure out, do we need another category, or is that part of the same category?
Because, yeah, you know, it's a good point, because could you, you know, what would you ask people on a telephone survey? Do you have, you know, are you aware of any holes in your teeth? Well, I guess you could do that. Obviously, you'd get different kind of answers than if a dental professional was looking in the mouth with a flashlight and tongue blades. So that would be the kind of, I think, maybe the next work that we would propose to NQF or back to the HHS, is that there ought to be some secondary process, not today, to define what these things might be or how you would gather the data. But the thing I was trying to get away from or get to was the idea of come up with some standard definition of what do you mean by caries in whatever circumstance, surveillance, survey, full dental office, and sort of get away from the, you know, 3.5-year-olds with brown hair. And if you had a standard definition, then people could use it in a lot of different ways.
Right. Well, why I'm raising the question about do you need a third category? Obviously, maybe my take of sort of what comes out in Haynes data versus National Survey of Children's Health are two different.
That's a good point. So you're suggesting maybe this a third category here would be useful.
Yeah,
that's
useful.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good.
I was going to say if you're just doing surveillance, that may be coming from school nurse and pediatrician as opposed to the dental people. So I agree. Maybe you have to define at what level are you going to be doing surveillance there.
One of the most difficult problems that we have in working with dentists and our expanded duty individuals who are licensed in Minnesota is the whole concept of caries measurement. Now, some of these people measure caries as it would have been back in the 1940s and 50s. And it runs all the way up to the most recent dental school classification of how to measure caries. So the problem is that we bring dentists in and talk to them about the service they're providing, and I purposely ask them how they're measuring caries. And they say, well, I use a very sharp explorer. And every little pit or fissure that sticks even a little bit, I put a restoration in there. And then it goes all the way up to dentists who understand the current incidence, distribution, etiology of dental caries. So they don't get excited about that at all. So it's really difficult to assume that a definitive clinical caries measurement among dentists or auxiliaries that have not been calibrated is going to make any sense. And some of the research that's going on now in the actual dental offices concerns me for that reason, that if these dentists are not highly calibrated in how to measure dental caries, you're going to result all over the place.
Well, A, we're never going to calibrate all the dentists. So, that's the difference in dealing in sort of health services type of an arena. But I do think, again, it comes back to a basic point, which is none of these measures or even a set of measures is going to be used to necessarily establish judgment about care. I mean, it can give you an indication, I think. But, go back to Jack Weinberg. At least in those situations, you'd start seeing variation, and then you're going to have to sort of, follow through after that to find out, how close that is to, what our recommended approaches that are contemporary and whatever. But that's where I think where we have to go.
Yeah, I agree with Jim, and I wasn't trying to imply that we were going to calibrate all the dentists in the United States. We're working on it.
But I guess the question that I would pose to the group to think about
could
is...
Could I just finish?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were.
I do think, though, that there are ways of measuring caries in populations who are receiving either commercial or government programs, dental care, that can provide the distribution that Jim was talking about, and that can be transformed into proxy quality measurements and also integrated into cost value measurements.
So I guess the question that I would pose to the group, I think based on this bit of discussion, is would there be value in suggesting to NQF and HHS that there be, that some work be done, again, not today, some work be done on a standardizing definitions of caries. So, for example, the ASTDD has a basic screening survey for kids and now one for adults or for older adults that has a pretty nicely put together definition of caries with calibration, with videos and slides to calibrate people. And I'm not suggesting that that's necessarily the right answer, but I'm thinking if something like that were to be adopted or something else were to be adopted that had those kind of tools with it, one could say, okay, this is the sort of gold standard we're going to adopt as a country for what measurements of caries would be. Now, if someone doesn't do that and they use some other measurement, they're not using the gold standard. So the question I'm posing to the group would, should we suggest that kind of work be done to try and come up with a sort of standard definition that people would shoot for and then realizing everyone's not going to do it?
Although I do not disagree, because it's a good thing, as Martha Stewart would say, in the end, it's like I remember when I did my heart failure work, and the patients were very worried that they had, I don't have a correct scale. It wasn't about the correct scale. It was about, are you gaining weight? And so it's all about the movement of the measure. So even if we're not all perfectly calibrated, it's about, is the average measure getting better? So, yeah, it would be very good if we had a standardized measure and everybody is calibrated. But in the end, it's about, are we making progress over 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, and are we seeing less caries? So I think, yeah, of course we should be calibrated, and of course we should have a better measure. But that's not, I think, the end point that we need to shoot for.
Okay. I think to that point, I think in the end, we're looking for measures that would eventually come to NQF to be endorsed, to be used on a very wide scale. So the more standardized they are, the better, because the committees who will ultimately have the discussions about which measure should be endorsed and which ones shouldn't will all be about the evidence surrounding that measure, how well it tested, and how well it can be applied across populations. So that's, I think, where we want to go in the end, but I completely understand your point. So I think the discussion now is, if we were going to recommend to measure developers what the best caries measure should look like that would come in and possibly get endorsed, what would it look like? And is it anything that you saw here already? Possibly. Any of the measures that you saw, is it any of one of those? I know, Richard, you talked about proxy measures that could work. Well, would any of those be sufficient enough to come in and get endorsed? Would they sort of meet the criteria to get endorsed? Could they be used across populations? Those are really the questions we should be thinking about when we're recommending, which way we move forward on these types of measures.
Just one caveat, though. I think
sure.
That the measures, the 275 measures, the 85 that had to do with caries in there, they really talk more about how they're used or the population or a sort of stratification. They don't really, what was listed on the sheets didn't actually define what the measure of caries was. So I don't think we're going to be able to look at that and say, was there something on the list that was the right measure of caries? Because that really wasn't on the list.
So Michael, Dick, and then I want to get over here.
I just wanted to support what Paul was saying, which is I do think that we should define how we're going to measure the basic thing. Which is caries. We've got these two diseases, well, three if you count oral cancer, but we've got caries, periodontal disease, and we've got a few others, but those are the big three. I think it's just super important to do what Paul said, which is establish just some baseline. This is the guidance for whoever is claiming to have more or less of caries or whatever. This is how it needs to be. These are the essential elements. You need to look in the mouth, et cetera. So there needs to be some guidelines, and that gets away from the gaps between sort of self-reported and survey stuff, which is all over the map and doesn't really correlate with either in the mouth or claim data. So I just wanted to second Paul's thing that I feel strongly that we should make a recommendation about that, because if we don't have that, then the data is really not worth a lot.
I just want to say I was at HHS last week presenting on oral health and actually met people there that are working to develop competencies that are going to be used by non-dental personnel for doing oral assessments and for doing all of the other components to it. So they will be establishing competencies that will be generic And I think that's where you will have, while we can't necessarily do an inter-reliability of testers or surveyors, there will at least be some competency base that it will be used as a tool. So I feel comfortable saying that there will be a standard that we can use.
Based on the research that we've done, I think there can be a different approach taken to this issue. And it's an approach that would be used in SCHIP, Medicaid, and commercial populations, where knowing the epidemiology of caries in a specific population, you can measure one dentist against another in terms of the way they practice that can be used as a proxy variable for their perception of how caries should be measured. However, an important thing should be noted that claims data cannot be used to measure caries.
Well, I was actually going to seek some clarification. I mean, because a couple of people have said a standard, and you talked about a way of measuring. I think the way of measuring needs to be also specified within the categories. Because, for example, the back to the point about others are going to be doing assessments. I mean, you know, the earlier work that I'm familiar with out of North Carolina, pediatricians, family physicians, you know, at the level of the mouth, you know, the accuracy is pretty good. At the level of the tooth, it's not. So I think, you know, and maybe even survey data, if it were asked better or had a better question, could get us closer to what objective sort of measures seem to be. So I think, you know, it's sort of pointing to best ways of measuring within data sources.
Just a point of clarification to sort of thinking about this, I see two different levels of measurement here. One measure is about how the dentists are diagnosing caries in the patient, and that's what Richard was talking about. But the other level of measurement is from a performance measurement perspective, which is how do you collect the data to understand whether what the proportion of caries is. So I think that's two different things. So there's a standard related to how you diagnose caries. But then how do you collect the information to report the performance measure?
Well, so I think that what I had proposed on the sheet was a call for development of two different definitions, one based on screening, examination, surveillance, and one based on examination with radiographs. And I think I agree with Jim. He suggests a third based on phone surveys. And that, as I'm hearing the discussion, still makes sense to me that what we would call for out of this meeting is say that there needs to be definitions developed for those three different ways of collecting data. Yeah, I think we talked about this on the phone call the other day. I don't think this process is about deciding who's going to use those measures or what they're going to do with them or what conclusions they're going to make once they gather the data. It's just right. About how what kind of measures should be developed. So.
Yep.
And I just want to echo that you cannot measure caries based on claims data or maybe therefore based on interviews, because somebody might have might perceive that they had caries because they had a filling or a crown, but maybe they didn't have. Maybe they had that for a different diagnosis. So I think we want to be very careful that we don't mix diagnosis and treatment, which you know, the public certainly does at times.
Okay. Although I think I just heard Jim suggest that based on phone surveys, you could get some information with an appropriately structured set of questions that might be useful.
It's something we can test.
Yeah. I mean, it's only something that someone who's proposing a measure and NQF could bring data, says, here's what we did, here's the way we measured it, here's the results, here's our reliability data. So, but I think he's pointed out correctly that would be a different set of considerations than one that was based on a surveillance where someone actually looked in the mouth versus radiographs would be a third category.
Right, and caries might be the hard one. There might be other measures that are very well measurable with interviews.
Yeah, and it might be that if we call for the development of measures in those three categories, that there wouldn't be one that would rise up to meet the NQF standards based on phone interviews. Maybe it's just not doable. So,
I just want to throw out another thought. Within those three categories, there are a lot of teledentistry where, you know, you do the screening using intraoral cameras from a remote site. Now, where would that kind of, you know, fit in? Would it be kind of a real examination, or would it be kind of similar to a telephone, but still there's more information because of the picture being broadcasted live? So I want the group to also think about, because there's a lot of technology being used as we move forward, so we also want to make sure that all of those areas is covered as well within the measures where we specifically say, you know, whether was it on-site or kind of remotely and some of those aspects.
That's an interesting question, and the question is that different than categorizing by screening examination versus full examination? And you could I could argue both ways. So we just actually completed a study at my institution looking at dentists' ability to make decisions based on a telehealth exam where they were reviewing telehealth records only versus telehealth records plus an in-person exam, and found that they made the same decisions based on both methods. So from that perspective, you could say that depending on how much data was gathered in the telehealth examination, it could either be a screening or it could be a full examination. Are there any other thoughts about this particular area? We're talking about just basically measurements of caries. I think the conversations are coalescing around that we suggest that measures be developed in three different categories of based on the sources of the data. Okay. Wow, I wasn't sure a few minutes ago we were actually going to come to closure on this, but we did. Congratulations. Okay. So let's see. So that was it. What else have we not talked about on there, Donna?
Yeah, I'm trying to just make sure we covered all of our bases here.
Well, the third bullet or the third sub-bullet, I think we, at least my opinion, that's going to be very hard to do. I don't see us being able to go back to the full, because there was actually no definitions of what carries.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the last bullet about across the priority area was really about, you know, if you looked at the measures that were existing, and Paul said it's hard to tell from what was listed there, but is there anything else we're not talking about as related to the priority area? So, you know, thinking about the concepts that Paul was talking about, is there anything else we're missing in terms of trying to measure reducing proportion of children with caries, or do we have it covered?
I'm wondering, in the risk of being a broken record, about the risk assessment, I'm not seeing anything there that might call on that. Knowing that even in the CDT book now, we see risk assessment there, and we see codes now having developed that rely on a risk having been done on a patient. And so, oddly enough, maybe, and not to be critical, there's no code for a risk assessment, which sort of is like, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? I'll take either as long as both follow. And so, again, I think very broadly, you know, a direction that this group could go would be to promote the use of risk assessment as a surrogate of quality. And it's building on a lot of things that there. I just want to note that I'm not sure I see that in here.
I think what you're suggesting is that we add that as another item that we call for development of measures of risk for dental caries.
Yeah.
Right. I agree with you.
And I don't see any patient safety measure. I only want to point that to the Diamante case, that there's no patient safety. And I think in any of these buckets, there should be a patient safety measure. And we can debate at length what that should be. But there's all kinds of patient safety measures that you can think about.
Could you just say something about what you mean
right
by that? Not to define it, but as an example, what would a patient safety measure related to caries
be? The Amenta case, very simple. Caries that was not diagnosed, not treated, and ended up in a fatality. So that would be extensive, untreated, undiagnosed disease.
So a little further down, there's an item that talks about signs of infection, pain, swelling, draining fistulas. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about, or is it something different than that?
I think along those lines, but
okay.
There's also safety issues of... Oh, sorry, my mistake. I have a little trouble pushing buttons. But also during treatment, patient safety issues. We just had a simple case where a patient was being treated and had an extensive burn from the drill. You know, so that is patient safety during treatment. So it's patient safety because of misdiagnosis, non-diagnosis, patient safety during treatment, or other kind of patient safety issues.
So maybe the one about safety during treatment we can hold, because there are some other categories we get more into measurement of processes that take place during dental office visits, so we can hold, let's not forget that one. And then the one about the caries leading to further kinds of complications we'll come to in a few minutes, so let's hold that one too. So.
Yeah, I was just going to suggest also that the, you know, patient safety, it's important that it sort of be a category even of its own. And, you know, I'd also, you know, broaden the realm to think of things like, you know, sedation, use of sedation, because, we don't see nearly the number of instances where that occurs. There's no really good reporting mechanism for that, but, you know, there are both deaths and morbidity as a result of kids being sedated to treat Gary. So, but I think that falls in the safety of the treatment realm, not in the caries realm.
There is a category of sedation and general anesthesia stuff that's coming up in a while too. So,
although I would really echo Jim's suggestion of a separate patient safety bucket, but then I'm very biased by Lucian Leap. That is my earlier conflict of interest.
Make sure we don't lose that by the end of the day. If we haven't come to it naturally in the course of moving forward, let's make sure we get back to that.
I also wanted to add it in terms of that definition in terms of defining caries. The population I work with are predominantly 0 to 5, and so the absence of their teeth, because they no longer have decays because of all the extractions. So somehow making sure we capture that. And again, also I want to get back to the sedation. You said we'll cover it later, because I know there's a proposal at some point in 2016 to be looking at that as a measure. It was a recommendation from the Organized Dentistry Coalition to be including addressing the issue of the use of sedation, not only for children, but also for adults.
Okay. Yes, I have one concern. I don't know whether or not this is appropriate, but when we talk about caries in, as a definition, should we consider, like, for example, the level of decay? In other words, the amount of structure that's actually involved when caries is detected, because that ultimately determines the procedure that leads to the outcome. So I'm wondering, do we need to drill down a little further?
Oh.
I mean, that's the use of diagnostic codes, or the lack of use of diagnostic codes, gets to that point, because diagnostic codes can differentiate caries to, you know, outer enamel, middle enamel, et cetera, and
or root
caries, exactly. And so just defining caries maybe doesn't go far enough, because there's a lot of research that would show that enamel caries can, in fact, be remineralized and should not, in fact, be drilled upon, which is the same point made earlier about if you do a beautiful crown on a tooth that doesn't need one, is that high quality? The same point, if you're drilling on an enamel lesion that we were all taught was the perfect board lesion, should you in fact have flunked that board because you failed treatment planning? Higher level. The Dental Practice-Based Research Network did a lot of studies on recognition and when to intervene on caries, and I think that work might be something that could be drawn upon.
So I think that's a good point. I think we should add that as we're talking about calling for people to develop measures of caries in the three circumstances that we've now listed, to put a footnote that also be valuable if they can include measures of the extent of caries, not just yes or no. So.
Can I just say one thing? I think we can train people to look at cavitated lesions and try to get, you know, sort of figure out that they can look at those the same. But I can tell you from my experience, you can't train dentists to look at non-cavitated lesions and do it comparably in any way, shape, or form. So to think that we can ever look at pure enamel decalcifications and include them, I think, is dreaming, because you just can't do that.
Well, of course, fortunately, that's part of the NQF process, is when someone submits a measure, they have to have data that they've used it, it's reliable, people can come up with the same answer in the same circumstance, so that'll be something that would fall out if it's not doable.
I thought the comments about measurements in terms of trying to determine quality, again, it depends upon the definition of quality. I think that technical quality is something that is very, very difficult to measure on a population of dentists. However, I think the quality of the decision-making process, in other words, diagnosis and treatment planning, can definitely be measured through various measurements that we've developed and others that other people have developed. And I think the quality of the diagnosis and treatment making process is key. In fact, it's at least as important as the quality of technical acumen.
Good. And again, I just would suggest hold that thought, because right now we're at a level of talking about the existence of disease in the population, and there is some stuff later on that talks about what dentists do. So I think that would be appropriate to bring back up at that stage.
Yeah, just another, maybe if you want to call it an attribute within these three different categories. For example, there was like different age groups within, you know, the different caries categories itself. Maybe kind of proposing kind of core attributes for each of the these categories that we recommend would be good, like, for example, age, gender, whatever that we need to measure, and maybe also kind of talking about what are the different population that these measures might be being viewed into.
I think that's something we could do. Let me just give you my thought about that, which is I think that would be hard, because if we come up with a definition of caries based on the stratification and the considerations we just come up with, that would be one bit of work. Once you have that definition, and say if you're going to, here's sort of the gold standard of measuring caries based on a screening examination where you're looking in the mouth, you could apply that across, you might come up with 50 or 60 or 100 different kinds of slices of the population, stratification based on age, stratification based on gender, socioeconomic status, some things that get at disparities, which we're going to talk about later on. So we could at some stage try to define what population should use that for. I don't know if it makes sense to try and do it at this stage.
Just to that point, I would just say that you're right, there were sub-priority areas which actually called out specific age ranges, and we're not going to talk about those in detail here, but I would say if, for example, there is an age cohort for which a concept we're talking about is very important because it's a certain stage of a person's growth where you want to focus there at that age, I'd say let's call it out. So if sealants are appropriate at age X, and that's a lot more important than age Y, please note it. But in general, I think most measures should be across the population, unless there's a specific reason to talk about a specific age.
Or if there's something different. If caries in diabetics is markedly different than caries in people with heart disease, we should talk about that. I don't know if that's a good example, but if there is something like that, then we should note that.
And this is what I've one of these things in the three categories that we've come up with. Telephone surveys, I think an important distinction is, are you answering for yourself? Are you answering for somebody else?
What we try to do in doing comparative measurements of populations is that we always adjust for SES, gender, and age. And when we do, we get very different results than when we don't.
And I would add, based upon some work we did on NHANES data a while back, race and ethnicity within age and SES even will give you variability. So, and I think that's, as Paul was saying, that's the important part, is that, you know, people realize that, you know, get as close to apples and apples comparisons as you can, because there is some value in having knowledge about the broad population, but certainly when you get into programs or whatever they're dealing with.
Groups that have, I mean, you know, just difference.
We will talk about disparities and stratification in a separate bucket entirely. But I would question, when you're talking about these measures, when the measure comes to NQF, you know, it needs to have a defined population. So is it all kids? Is it all adults? Is it the whole population? Do you cap the age? So we just need to know right now in terms of caries, would you say the measure would be appropriate if it came in for all patients in general?
Yes.
Okay, so that's just good to know it. Thank you.
Okay, so now we're going to – we've gotten through the first of 600 things we need to talk about today. All right, so maybe we'll speed up. So now the second item on the same first page there is OH2, which is reduce the portion of children and adults with untreated dental decay. And what's not repeated, obviously the measure of caries applies there as well, but we won't talk about that again. But there's a couple of other things that we haven't talked about yet, although they came up just peripherally, we should talk about. So there's some measures that don't measure decay as a single entity, but measure it as a component of DMF or DMFT, so decayed, missing, and filled teeth. And then there's another separate one that was called out and came out in many different places, which is various signs of infection, which can be, using the ASTDD definition, they refer to that as signs of urgency. This sort of translates the problem into a reaction to it, but it really is, they were all signs of infection, which is pain, swelling, or draining fistulas. So, again, the idea here would be to call for measured development in these two areas and further definition. So let's have some discussion about those two areas or anything else that would be different about adolescents or children or adolescents.
Jim and then Dick.
Paul, I think, you know, the under the one that's sign of infection, pain, swelling, fistula, et cetera, I think a point was made earlier, but the importance of capturing data from emergency departments and other areas other than just in the sort of in the dental care delivery system, I think is really an important one for looking at systems and for connectedness across dental services and medical services, et cetera.
I don't believe, and we talked about this before, that you can use claims data as a surrogate measurement for DMF and DMFT. It just is unreliable, completely.
Well, it's not only unreliable. You're using a treatment to relate to a diagnosis. It's not even apples and pears. It's apples and vegetables.
I agree.
I'd just also like to point out one of the signs of long-range disease and acute consequence. One of the things that I include in my presentations is having medical providers look at failure to thrive in children, because there's often indications that are there the child's not eating. And I tell the provider, look and see what the child's state of their mouth is, and they're not eating because the severity of their disease is significant. But they're under the age of 3, and they're not able to communicate that they're having pain. But what they're doing is not eating and not sleeping and not growing, as evidenced by their growth percentiles being tracked. So is there some indication there that might just, as an added note?
I'm just trying to think about, is that a data source, or is that a different concept to measure? In other words, if they had failure to thrive, they'd want to look, you said, look at their mouth. What would they be looking for? They'd be looking for signs of pain, infection, or swelling, I think. So maybe it's the same concept, but a different data, adding a different data source, you're suggesting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I just was wondering, is this a measure that's actually measuring the performance of the dental providers, or is this measuring the state of our dental access? Because DMF may not have anything to do with the dental people seeing these kids, because the kids never actually make it to the office. So I think we have to define who we're measuring there, because I don't think that necessarily reflects poor performance by the providers.
So I think this sheet is talking about the characteristics of the people, not the service delivery system or who they're seeing or if they're seeing anybody. It's really the people themselves, their conditions.
Well, I guess I want to have you elaborate on that then, because my answer was going to be it could be both. I mean, you could have, once a provider assumes some responsibility for care, if patients, you know, large numbers of patients keep having infections and, you know, and can't really get in, I think that's an indicator of the performance of the provider.
No,
but at a system level, you can have the same thing going on, and kids spilling over into emergency rooms simply because they can't even get access to even start the care. So it could be a system issue. It could be a provider issue.
No, I totally agree with that. And I'm sorry if what I said might have suggested otherwise. The only thing I was suggesting was that the actual concepts on this sheet are concepts related to the patient, conditions in the patient. Now, you could use that measurement to decide, are they under good care, are they seeing the right people, are the right things being done for them, but the concept is actually related to the patient.
Michael. Yeah, I just wanted to sort of pick up. I know when you were kind of organizing this initially, it was by either surveillance or in a dental office, this diagnosis of caries. But I think what we're hearing is that there we should probably have another category, which is in medical settings, you know, broadly, where other things are triggering it, as you described, you know, the failure to thrive. But it does seem like that's another, it's another source, potential source of information about the, certainly when the subjective complaints arise, you know, the child's not sleeping and whatever, and they're in a medical setting, not a dental setting. So I'm just suggesting maybe that's a, we should call that out as another kind of an event. We've got phone surveys, we've got in-the-mouth screenings by dental professionals, presumably. We've got in the dental office assessment, and then we've got other medical settings, I guess, is what I'm just,
so Mike, again,
I'm hearing
just trying
maybe
to...
that's a discrete setting where maybe a different set of protocols might be used.
Well, I guess that's the question I would ask you or anyone else who wants to weigh in on it would be, we're talking about a source of data, and we're talking about the definition. So, if you have a definition, if there was, if the call was for some for people to develop definitions of measurements of pain, infection, and swelling, or signs of infection, which would be pain, swelling, or draining fistulas, and that might not even be what the actual measure is that someone proposes, but some kind of signs of dental infection. And then collecting that data in a medical setting versus in a dental setting, would the definition be different, or would it just be applying that definition in a different location?
Go ahead, Jim.
I'm not sure how to answer your last question, but I'll give you an example.
Well, I'm just trying to understand.
I'll give you an example, and you fit it into your terminology. I mean, I think there are issues about if they come through an emergency room specifying or, you know, testing at least what's the best way to determine that, because I mean Pew put out a report fairly recently, and my read of that was I think they looked at primary and secondary diagnosis, but I know other people that have looked deeper, you know, an additional number of diagnoses turn up dental cases. So I think that you know, from the standpoint of whether you call that just a different data source, you know, making the point that work needs to be done, and you know, NQF process, I assume, would sort of handle that. That different mechanisms or you know, recommendations for the best way to measure that within those particular strata would be an important part of the work going forward.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay. I just would say that the please pardon my voice today. Bronchitis, I think, starting yesterday. I think the medical record might be useful for identifying people with a particular condition for which you think that dental care might be indicated, and then you would look at the claims record in the dental system to determine whether or not the care was there. But it seems to me unlikely that a pediatrician who puts down a primary diagnosis of failure to thrive is going to actually record a secondary diagnosis of dental caries or something that, you know, so that the medical record alone is not going to be useful, I guess, is my point. Linking the claims records across medical and dental is what's most useful, I think.
I just want to say I think it's important to the signs of infection, I think, is very important, and I think it's important to develop a definition that works across, you know, different treatment areas and also different locations. I can tell you, if you go to the Navajo Reservation and you look at kids, the people who serve those folks are kind of jaded by how many infections they see, and they don't consider a draining fistula a big deal. They only consider facial swelling a big deal. And I think we need a standard definition that respects the pain and suffering people are going through everywhere, not just in certain locations.
But I think one thing I'm just hearing, just to summarize, hearing here is that we, in putting out a call for a definition in this area, we might want to at least note that the definition might be different based on the data source. I'm not sure if it is, but at least make that as a note. So.
And the other last comment is that the signs of infections are sitting in the bucket of untreated dental decay, but it could also be a periodontal reason or another reason. So I'm not sure if it needs to be sitting in every bucket or that it needs to be sitting in its own bucket. It's just that it's linked. It doesn't have to be only linked to this bucket. That's the only issue that I have with it.
And Donna, I think you have repeated it, that one. It comes up in several places here because of that. And maybe it needs to come up in a few more places, too. So as we go through, let's watch for the sort of places that needs to be repeated.
Yeah, or just lift it out and be separate, something like that.
Thank you. Well, this is organized by the Healthy People priority, so that's the kind of categories we're using. So. Okay, any other comments on that one? So I didn't hear any comments about the DMF or DMFT. I think there are definitions out there, but I don't know that they're NQF endorsed definitions, so that maybe that's a call for someone to do that.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to highlight that seems like a really logical thing, because DMFT is it's a good measure of history of dental experience. You know, how many teeth have active decay, how many teeth are missing as a result of dental disease, how many teeth have been filled, is how much treatment activity has occurred. So I think that measure is a good measure of that history. So I think that ought to be something we ought to highlight, I guess.
Well, it's a history of treatment. It's not a history of diagnosis. So we want to be really, really careful because teeth can be missing for a whole bunch of reasons. It doesn't have to be caries.
So we just
need to be very careful about that.
Right. It would span all of our disease categories.
Right. So again, it doesn't probably belong in this bucket. Congenital reasons, you know, just impacted wisdom. There's lots of reasons why teeth are missing. So I want to just be careful that we don't think it only belongs in this bucket.
Right. So this is another one that is repeated in multiple places, and maybe, again, we'll watch for it may need to be repeated. And it's a little awkward trying to fit these things into the healthy people categories because we're talking about some things that don't neatly fit into a healthy people category. But okay, so then I think we're ready to move to the one on adults.
Can I just have one more thing, and maybe this is a question that I should have asked earlier for NQF, and specifically the limitation of limiting to only the OH1 and OH2. The one thing that it came up in some conversation around oral health of children and adolescents was trauma, since that's such a significant issue for children, especially injury and trauma. If there's something that if that's a concept that needs to be part of the oral health of children and adolescents, is some measurement around that?
Let me just sort of speak more to our process, which was working from the priorities and then working down. So we fit whatever measures we found into the priority areas, OH1, OH2. But, you know, if you think that there's a concept that would fall under a higher level priority area that's completely missing, feel free to throw that out there. But again, we were just working with whatever priority areas there were listed. So OH1 was caries, OH2 is decay, and that's where we stopped.
But I think it's worth noting, we've heard two now that may end up, as we're done at the end of the day, come back to make sure that they don't get lost and maybe need their own category, which is patient safety.
Trauma might
need to be.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say if trauma is not in there, and it's not trauma only about sports, trauma around injuries. Trauma around domestic violence, which is a huge issue. I think if trauma is not in here, it better get in here.
Okay. So we can include trauma and patient safety as its standalone buckets later on.
Maybe we should just if they haven't been covered as we go through the various things, then we'll come back to them.
Okay.
That's the way to do it.
And I also want to just remind you, so we were talking about the two concepts under OH1 and the two concepts under OH2. Just to remind you, those are concepts that relate to the measures we found, meaning they were somewhere in the scan. But there could be other measures out there that are important related to that priority area, and that's the question about, is there a gap still? So there's just DMF and sign of infection that we found measures for related to this priority area, but are there any other concepts that relate to this priority area that are not listed here? And we definitely want to talk about that. And if they are, please throw them out.
Jim? And then Michael?
That actually just triggered a thought because, I mean, you know, things like DMFT typically are assessed clinically, but there's another measure that's reported often, which is unmet treatment needs, which may have different criteria, and I don't know whether that belongs here or not.
Michael, and then Dick. Yeah, I don't know. Were you asking Paul for an answer or if, anyone?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, sort of part of the My quick concept
is that there is an access category,
isn't there, coming up, that
it might fit better under that.
It's priority area C, which I think has to do with access. So let's not lose that. Make sure that that does get included when we get into that area.
I had another sort of reaction. It was keying off of the whole safety and the reference to abuse and the whole issue around vulnerable people. I'm sort of an elder care person here. We'll get to elder neglect concepts, probably later. But child neglect and sort of the whole issue of when you have a vulnerable person for whom who is dependent on another person to make their health decisions. So a child would obviously fall into that category. There's that whole issue around neglect, which is an aspect of safety. Are you in an environment where you're safe? And you could be either not safe because your parents don't get you any kind of health care at all, or, or don't care if you're crying or have infections or whatever. Or you could be not safe because they're actually, abusing you or whatever. But I just wanted to raise the whole neglect and the whole caregiver aspect as an aspect of quality that the health system needs to identify where there are breakdowns. In that, somehow.
So
I don't know where.
Keeping a list of things that we're bringing up that may or may not get covered later, and we'll definitely want to come back to all of them, make sure that they get included. So far, I've got unmet treatment needs, neglect, patient safety, trauma, injuries. I got unmet needs twice. So,
cool.
When you look at OH2, it's somewhat concerning that we only have two measurements. And as far as I'm concerned, I have very little confidence now in DMF and DMFT, no matter if it's measured in an EPI survey or in an office or whatever, because I think in general it overmeasures the incidence and or prevalence of dental caries in the population.
I just want to clarify that that's what you're talking about is really an artifact of the way this spreadsheet got put together. It wasn't to suggest that when you're measuring in OH1, which is children with dental experience in their primary or permanent teeth, and OH2 is children, adolescents with untreated decay, that the first two only belong to the first category and the second two only belong. That wasn't the idea. Obviously, measures of decay belong in the second category as well, and maybe when you're done with this process, Donna, you can lengthen this document even further by repeating those things in the places where they need to be repeated. But right.
And then, maybe to try to interpret what I think Dick's saying is, if you just looked at DMFT or DMFS, that as an indication of caries, the fact that the T's are already done and you don't know why the T's were done. But we're not getting down to the level of specification now that just basically says DMFT. I mean, there are sort of ratios, decayed over DMFT or decay, percent decayed or number decayed, those kind of things that are derivative sort of that general approach to measurement, right? And that's detailed to be dealt with later.
And I would say that when I first just pulled out these concepts, I didn't have them organized by these healthy people priorities. So because that was the charge to the NQF, the staff did put them back in that. But my idea was let's look at the concepts, because clearly DMFT doesn't belong only in this little bucket here, and caries doesn't only belong in the bucket above that. So I think maybe our work today, we want to try to help staff meet their goal, which is to respond to HHS about the priorities, but also realize we're talking about concepts that cross many, many lines here. So.
And then Dick, please.
Just another area, looking at the signs of infection, pain, swelling. I mean, what about, drug-seeking behavior at the medical center because of some of these dire oral pain or maybe they are, that needs to be reported in some way or fashion. So I don't know whether it would fit in here or maybe in some other area we might want to address that as well.
I think that's good to note that as a potential data source for that.
I would say one's confidence in DMF or DMFT and its derivatives is must be consistent with the confidence that you have in the individual measurements themselves and in the collective measurements, and that's where I have problems.
Well, again, I think what we'd be doing here is calling for people to develop measures that they would submit to NQF potentially or other places, and because of the nature of how those measures get proposed and submitted and analyzed, that if someone can come up with something that does make sense and has the right definitions and has reliability, then it might be adopted, or if they can't, then they won't. So,
but I would say in your discussions, if you're coming up with concepts that you think, you know, would be feasible for most people to do, meaning it could come reliably from claims, then it's probably preferential over something that you have to get from a medical record, obviously for the burden issue or for a survey. You know, so if there's something here that lends itself very well to a claims-based measure, please call that out. Or something that lends itself very well to or is connected very well to an evidence base, we would like you to please call that out, because those are priority areas. You know, priority is doing measures at a population level that are easier to do, meaning instead of going into the medical record and collecting information, you can get it from claims, or there's a great evidence base. Those are definitely priorities. Eventually, you know, I think we want to get to the best information, and maybe EHR is the way, but not everyone has one of those, as we know. So.
Can I ask for clarification? You say claims. Are we only looking at dental claims?
Well,
because I thought we would include medical, because here again, that integration is critical. Because here I would state that the medical provider who does find a failure to thrive would, in fact, put a diagnostic code as to the possible cause, which could be multiple. But if there is, in fact, evidence of the decay, I think that's an important factor. And, again, because of the fact that the majority of people have greater access to medical care and they're having to fill in claims, particularly for government programs, that this would be a reliable source of data.
Sure, and if you think that's a data source that represents the concept well, I would definitely suggest you to call that out as an option to explore for a measure developer, for sure.
Well, and signs of infection and trauma are both going to usually be evaluated probably by a pediatrician before maybe even making it to the dental. So that medical claims and those particular issues are probably going to pick up those things a little bit faster or maybe a little more complete.
Okay. Anything else in this one?
Great. So let's pause now. We've sort of gotten through that first one and got our heads wrapped around the process. At least let's take a little bit of a break. Thank you for your patience with me and sort of being the traffic cop. I know sometimes I skipped some of you or passed over you, and I appreciate your patience with that. But I think that's how we're going to divide things up. I'm going to be the traffic cop and timekeeper, and Paul's going to be sort of helping us along as much as we can in the process. So let's take a 15-minute break.
Sure.
15-minute break, bio break, Outlook, BlackBerry, all that stuff. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. I think we're going to go ahead and get started. We are on priority area B. Let me remind everyone, too, if you see some concepts in here that aren't really all that important related to the priority area, please don't feel like you can't say that, because we'll get to the prevention suite and the access suite where there's 40 concepts or 30 different measures. And, you know, again, back to the burden issue, we can't measure everything. So if there's 20 concepts under prevention, we need to focus on the ones that are higher priority, meaning they're more important, there's an evidence base, they're less burdensome. Let's concentrate on those. So, again, if you see something in here that may or may not be a great measure concept, please feel free to mention that as well.
Why don't we get started with B? Maybe what I'll do is I'll continue to be the traffic cop and the timekeeper, and maybe we'll sort of split across starting these conversations.
Okay.
All right?
So in area B, and I think, again, just to the point that got raised towards the end of the last discussion, although the staff has repeated some things, they haven't repeated everything, and many of these things could be repeated in every section here. So the priority area B starts with oral health of adults, and I think everything we've already talked about, all those measures we've already talked about, those concepts could be so that we're not going to go through them again for adults unless you see something specific about adults that wasn't addressed previously. But otherwise, I just added a couple of things that struck me as different than that had been talked about, which was these two concepts for adults, ill-filling dentures and ability to chew or discomfort in chewing were two of the measures that sort of came out as different for adults. So let's just have some conversation about those concepts.
Yeah, I just, my only thing is just to call out root caries. You know, with the typical caries assessment, was related to coronal caries and caries experience among children and so forth, whereas older adults experience root caries when they have had a history of periodontal disease, and diagnosing it and tracking it isn't hasn't been done in very well to date. So I just, it's an example of caries. We did talk about whether or not we wanted to actually diagnose it with some specificity. And certainly caries on the root surface would be fall under that. But I didn't want us to lose root caries because that's a very significant disease, especially in the old.
Okay. No good. I think that does seem different than what we were talking about previously. Yeah, good.
Amy? Well, I don't know where this is going to fit. I'm trying to look through you, but, you know, non-healing ulcers and leukoplakia need to go somewhere in this. And I don't know if it's in this, oral health, or if it's somewhere else, and I can search through and see. But, you know, one of the measures that we have in head and neck cancer is early diagnosis and staging drastically affects prognosis. And so this is screening for oral cavity cancer. It's got to fit somewhere in here, and maybe it's in oral health and maybe it's somewhere else. But I think it has to be a measure.
Coming
up pretty soon.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else about the two concepts that were listed here, ill-fitting dentures or ability to chew discomfort chewing? Okay. So, again, the call is going to be for a call for people to develop more specific measures related to those concepts.
Or is it? That's another question. I mean, are those important enough areas that there should be a call for measures in those areas? That's the question. Just because they were found in the scan doesn't mean necessarily that they should be submitted. So that's a question back to the group. Are these areas very important? Or are there more important areas that you would focus on if you had a choice?
I can chime in as the geriatric dentist. I guess I didn't point that out, but my background is as a geriatric dentist. Certainly among the old, which are people 85 plus, where the prevalence of partial and complete edentulism is very high, if you ask people, you know, about their oral function, their oral health, whether or not they can smile to, you know, and do that with comfort versus with pain and so forth is really critical to them. So I think these are important, particularly for that age cohort.
I just wondered when I saw the one on ability to chew, how you would assess that on a population-wide basis.
Or if it's are those the nursing home measures that?
Yeah, I can comment on that. Yeah. They're part of the MDS 3.0, the federally mandated set of assessments for people in nursing homes, and they are that's the way they're currently collected. Is it's part of an assessment typically done by an assessment team, usually involving nurses. We have oral health professionals in our model that do those oral parts of the assessment, but that's where it's currently being collected.
There's a group of, or a work that's called Oral Health Quality of Life that I'm sure many of you are aware of. Mike John out of the University of Minnesota has been part of that work, and we recently validated a 5-question piece of that work that goes to some of these questions and really asks patients in their terms whether they're happy with their quality of life. I find it very interesting, and because many times as dentists, you know, we'll walk into a treatment room and look at a patient that's missing every other tooth, and thinking, you know, oh my gosh, you know, you're just in terrible shape, and they say they're doing fine, and they're very happy with their function and things, and you know it, that's really where we should be focusing many times. And so I think it might be interesting to note that, because there's a lot of research around that oral health quality of life study. I think it's been done extensively in Europe.
And there are well-validated tools for that.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. So that might be a data source for that kind of concept.
And anything coming out of Minnesota is, of course, as Garrison Keillor says, you know, above average.
Yes, exactly.
So you can note that as well.
Right. I think maybe I just want to note, rather than take the next one at a time, because they're kind of overlapping a little bit, let's just note that the next concepts, the bottom of this page and the top of the next page, broken teeth, missing teeth, extractions, edentulism, bleeding gums, loose teeth, and oral lesions were the other sort of health concepts that were appeared in one or more places in the general list of measures. So we can talk about them now, maybe one at a time, but keep in mind that was the things that I at least pulled out of the general set of measures. So comments about in any of those, really?
One thing I did want to mention that seems to be begging and everything we're kind of looking at is, I think we're going to have to at least put on the table that there will have to be a movement toward diagnostic coding of some type that differentiates the various degrees of disease that these individual measures are looking at. We're going to have to somehow come to a point where we have an agreement so that it's easily translatable between professions like medicine and dentistry, because otherwise we're just looking at state of being. This is, you don't have a tooth, you got a decay. These are just to me just nebulous. It doesn't really get down to what we really need to do is a set of diagnoses with a set of outcome goals and a plan how to address those issues. That's where we need to go. Where we are is not adequate. And I know that we have to deal with the realism of where we are. I understand that. But I think also for this panel, we need to recommend that as a country, we've got to move in another direction.
So I think we had identified that earlier on with caries was the idea. If you're going to develop a measure of caries, you might want to suggest or encourage people to develop that not only yes or no, but a differentiation. And you're suggesting that as a more general principle for all these measures, not just a yes or no, but more a stratification of how severe the problem is.
Chris, being a member of the Code Committee, do you know what the latest stance is of the ADA on the development of diagnostic codes?
Through the chair. Yes, you know, it's there are issues related to the development of diagnostic code sets, modifiers, and the like that are not because of intransience, but because, frankly, we're up against some barriers that perhaps the NQF can identify. When we take a look at diagnostic code sets, be it Elsbeth's or the ADA's, you know, these code sets exist. They're basically input code sets, and we need output code sets, so we've mapped them all to ICD. Problem that we have is that ICD currently is not as granular as we would like it. It doesn't include enough concepts to really be rich enough for what you're all calling for around this table. Yet there's a moratorium right now on any sort of changes or additions to ICD. You've got ICD-10 also on the horizon, or is it? There's now potentially delay on whether or not we'll even go to ICD-10. So as Elsbeth and I were talking about earlier, the earliest avenue we have right now for even hoping of inclusion of diagnostic code sets is ICD-11. We also had an interesting conversation just recently regarding modifiers and the incorporation of modifiers into the code set, because the ADA is interested in bringing forward modifiers as part of it. And it's surprising, because in code development for many years, the payers have often said, we want modifiers, and it has gone nowhere. And now that the ADA has come to the table and said, yes, we're ready to go with modifiers, the payers have said, whoa, wait a minute, the cost to implement that, the barriers that we're coming up with as far as all the health care reform and things that payers are looking at, they don't want to look at modifiers for another 3 to 5 years. So there's a lot of institutional issues. There's a lot of regulatory issues. The code sets exist right now. Both these code sets being mapped to ICD and getting ICD to be a little more granular to accept the dental concepts for output, not just the input at the coding in the patient record site, but also the output into the claims system is where the big problem is. And I think that we can identify that and say we've got to find, at least on the oral health side, the ability to make ICD more granular to accept these dental concepts.
Just a response. I would suggest that you have the wrong payer representatives on the committee.
I'm not sure how to interpret that, but just to add to the comment, being the very practical Dutch person that I am, waiting is not part of my vocabulary. So I simply developed a dental diagnostic terminology that is very practical, that is now being implemented by 15 schools, Children's Hospital, a very, 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 very large dental practice group. And we have now 1.6 million patient visits per year that are actually using this dental diagnostic terminology. It's been validated, evaluated through a very rigorous R01 research project. So although indeed it's not part of ICD-10 yet or ICD-9, it's actually out there. It's being used. So I would argue that there's something out there that's validated, that's being used, that works. So we could say that there's nothing. We can also say there's something that potentially we can look at, and that's better than ICD.
So I just want to ask Donna a question for you to respond to in terms of this. This has come up before and probably will come up many times today. The idea, a lot of the things we're going to talk about point to, well, if we had diagnostic codes or if we had a universally accepted diagnostic codes, the world would be better in some way. I'm not sure what the relation is between that discussion and what we're doing today, and I don't know if we ought to just sort of say, okay, we've recognized that we need diagnostic codes now. We probably shouldn't keep coming back to that because it's not actually part of today's work, or maybe I'm incorrect about that, so I'm trying to get your read on that.
No, I mean, I think primarily, you know, the conversation should be about what is most important and feasible right now, because those measures are going to be developed and submitted, or hopefully eventually be submitted as standardized measures, but probably the best measures that get at the most important issues are measures that we don't currently have data sources for. And that's where we need to go. So I think it's definitely two different conversations. I don't want to say don't have that conversation because it's very important, and those are the measures we ultimately need. So I think you know, the general conversation about diagnosis codes and how we're going to get there, I think we can have right now. When you're talking about a specific area, let's focus on what we can do, what's most feasible. And then also, if you think there are other measures that we ultimately need to get to, we can mention them and say, you know, the committee noted it would also be great to measure X, Y, Z, because this is where the evidence is, this is where we need to go, and make a note of it. Because I don't want to leave that out. I think it's very important. We just need to note that this is what we can do, this is what we would like to do.
So in some sense, we're talking today about the concepts that need to be measured.
Right.
Diagnostic codes would be one data source or one way of getting at that, but to the extent we have it or don't have it, the concept might not change.
Yeah.
Might be a better way to get the data.
And just a quick comment, and I like the idea of this group potentially showing leadership and to express that desire for a movement towards diagnostic codes. That may be the only thing that we can do, and then not just beat it over the head
right
every time that we have the open mic.
Amit and then Diane.
I'll wait.
All right, just kind of moving along here. BOH5, I mean, I look at bleeding gums and loose teeth, but maybe the concept is, you know, periodontitis there. I mean, as Paul has clearly mentioned it there. There is a definition from the CDC and American Academy of Periodontology which looks at a couple of these, I think probing depth and clinical attachment loss. And so maybe trying to look at the moderate and severe periodontitis based on some of those guidelines might be good. However, that is based for surveillance on a population base rather than the clinical definition of periodontitis. And when we come to the clinical definition of periodontitis, everybody here know how complicated it is. There's different sets of definitions out there. But I just wanted to point out that there is a definition from CDC and American Academy of Periodontology for assessing moderate and severe periodontitis based on different sites and also based on the two variables that they look into.
So just to point out that the periodontitis did come up as a concept in the long medicine. It's actually on page 4 this for no particular reason. So it could be here as well. But I think you're adding something different because what was actually pulled out of what was in the large measure set was periodontal screening, and so periodontal screening could be one thing. Your periodontitis definition could be something else. So maybe we need to think about periodontitis multiple measures, including things like bleeding gums and loose teeth, and then actual clinical definitions of periodontitis based on either screening or full examinations.
That was a question actually I was going to ask because if you look at the healthy people, again, it was BOH5, and it says adults age 45 to 74, it excludes all pregnant women who we know have gingivitis, which is bleeding gums. It also excludes the consideration that some of the studies are finding that we're seeing periodontal disease evidence in 11 and 12-year-olds as pre-indicators to type 2 diabetes. It's a comorbidity, but it's not addressed anywhere. And a generic category that someone brought up in a conversation I had was we really don't see any discussion about soft tissue as an evaluation and whether or not this is something we should be looking at as a standard or something that we should be evaluating as a quality.
Michael, did you have a comment? Yeah, I don't know if there's people want to respond to that. I thought that was interesting. So I had something different to say. So
I want to make sure we don't lose the idea about soft tissue. You know, there is a category here that says oral lesions, and so when we talk about that, let's talk about whether that's way too broad, if we need to differentiate that more further.
Okay, because oral lesions, I'm starting to think about the evidence of, you mentioned oral cancer detection, and we previously thought of it in people 40 and older, but the research is showing younger ages not related to high-risk behaviors such as smoking or tobacco use, but rather as a result of sexually transmitted diseases, specifically HPV. And where are we including some discussion or awareness of that?
All right, so let's come back to that. It'll actually be the next thing we talk about once we come to these ideas of missing broken and teeth and then periodontitis, and then we'll come to lesions. So.
I just wanted to speak about extractions and, in particular, the rate of loss of teeth. There have been a number of international studies looking at the rate of loss of teeth as a proxy for the cumulative experience of a mouth infection, both caries and periodontal disease. So the rate of loss of teeth is it's a good indicator of the rate of impact of these mouth infections in damaging the mouth. And anyway, I just wanted to raise that as an issue. You know, I think if we could develop, and that's probably something we can measure with claims data and other data that's out there, is how rapidly and during what periods of the lifespan. So you can have rapid, you know, in the 1900s you had rapid loss of teeth in childhood with people being edentulous from the time they were in their 20s or 30s until they died. And now we have this compression of morbidity where people are healthier and healthier in their childhood, and then they have this compression of disease at the end when they get dry mouth and all these other conditions. So anyway, I just wanted to raise the notion of the rate of loss of teeth. I know it's been studied in connection with a number of different diseases, including just even lifespan. There's a correlation between the rate of loss of teeth and a shorter lifespan, for example.
So we could add that in addition to what the other ones, which are pretty static measures. This is a great measure over time. So
yeah.
Okay.
I'd just like to make a comment about the rate, and I am looking at my more detailed BOH, right? BOH, and an extraction rate. There, one of the example measures that you pulled out requires a 2-year continuous eligibility requirement to even show up in the denominator. And it, I just wanted to raise this because I think that it applies. It's a problem not only for extraction rate, but for any of these measures. You need somehow or another, this group, NQF, needs to identify a look-back period that's reasonable and won't result in exclusion of most of the population. And this is even assuming that people are insured and we're getting claims data from for them.
Well, 2 points. I mean, one is I assume that issue is going to be dealt with sort of through the harmonization aspect of things, because I mean that's a general point that goes well beyond just extractions.
Right.
I mean, you know, looking differences between CMS criteria of eligibility versus NCQA versus any sort of adjusted piece, you know, that's going to apply across everywhere. And at least my understanding of the current framework is that harmonization is where that comes up, so that it may not dictate which measure somebody uses, but at least sort of points out where the apples and the pears or the whatever they are, you know, for comparison. The other point I was going to make, though, specifically related to extractions, based upon some work we did many years ago when I was at Connecticut, looking at a population in both Connecticut and North Carolina, you know, not to in any way detract from Mike's point about sort of rates and relationship to diseases or whatever. But, I mean, socioeconomic status and options available were clearly major determinants of decisions for extraction. And so that's another sort of element that has to be captured somewhere because, you know, we had buckets of extracted teeth and measured clinical conditions, and some of them were still in people's – some of them were no longer in somebody's mouth, but would have been the clinical condition, and certainly the treatment options were extensive. But, you know, depending on whether they had coverage and whether they had financial resources, they were in a bucket as opposed to in somebody's mouth.
Yeah, good. And I just want to make a comment about this, about the denominator issue, which is that I think that at least a suggestion, and see if the group agrees or disagrees with it, but is that we probably don't get too deeply into that today, because I think if we're talking about it applies to every measure here, you know, who's the population you're studying and how do you define it. So I think it would be one of the things that would fall under the category of stratification. So if we have a measure for caries, we come up under caries measures 3 or 4, depending on the data source. Then you can use that measure whether you're talking about three-year-olds who've been continuously enrolled in X program for this amount of time. So the denominator, many different cuts on the denominator, but I think the point we've tried to emphasize is that we need a standard definition that can be applied in all these settings. So.
Michael and Amit?
Sorry. I don't know if we want to go on about extractions anymore. I was going to bring up xerostomia. So I wanted to bring up the topic of xerostomia, which isn't listed in here, but dry mouth. This is a very serious condition for adults and actually pushing into younger adults as more younger adults are taking chronic medications earlier to prevent or delay chronic diseases. So dry mouth is a really important symptom and risk factor for dental problems.
Just kind of more on lines of kind of disease or conditions. I look at missing teeth and edentulism kind of being part of because of dental caries or periodontal disease, but that could also be because of congenitally missing, you know, teeth and their, you know, oligodontia or anodontia. Does it need a separate bucket on its own in terms of, you know, how are we going to do that? Would it be part of our, and I know this might even be crossing both priority areas A and B because depending upon when that is measured.
Right? You're suggesting a separate measure for congenitally missing teeth, which would be different than the current measure. Missing teeth could be for many causes, or edentulism could be for many causes. But, okay.
But they're so hard to measure.
It might be difficult. Again, that would be the challenge for if you call for measures in that area. Someone's going to have to propose that and how they're going to do it and how they're going to gather the data. It might be. Might fall out because it's hard to do, but we can at least list it as a potential. So we've talked about some of the measures of teeth that are gone or partially gone, broken teeth, missing teeth, extractions, edentulism,
rate of tooth loss. Mike suggested a new category, which I don't think fits in any of those, under xerostomia, and sort of a modification of the missing teeth, which is congenitally missing teeth. And then we've talked a little bit about periodontal disease, bleeding gums, loose teeth, and then actual measures of periodontal disease itself, whether a clinical examination or a screening examination. Anything else that goes, before we get to oral lesions on the next topic, anything else that goes into oral, other oral health conditions of, so I guess tooth-related oral health conditions of adults?
I'm really not trying to irritate you by bringing up risk assessment, but risk assessment really, I mean, it embodies so many of these things. Okay, so like xerostomia, an excellent question or element of a risk assessment is the medical history of the patient and whether or not they're taking xerostomic medications that drives caries. And so it to me, you know, maybe I describe myself as just super practical rather person that just says, you know, why do we want to have measures around xerostomia or some of these other things that we're touching on if it were not the means to the end on how we can evaluate that patient better and develop a treatment plan that's appropriate for them.
So you're suggesting that tied to periodontal disease, risk assessment.
Yeah, absolutely. Good. You know, well, in caries.
Well, we got it for caries, but you're suggesting getting it here. So. My question for you, David, is in Minnesota, is everybody at above average risk?
We're below.
I can answer that, too.
We talked about above average. Actually, I thought he was going to say the thing that characterized Minnesota was that we were cold. So I'm, you know.
Actually,
well, we're losers, actually, as evidenced by
in Minnesota,
the Gophers last night, you know. Not a good showing.
Actually, in Minnesota, the commercially insured population is at very low risk. And other than the safety net clinic patients, the government programs patients are at relatively low risk, too. But that's Minnesota.
Along the lines of risk assessment, though, and I don't know, but when you go to do your billing for various levels of care, I assume part of that is we are inclusion of a review of systems, right? That's what we do in medicine. And the more complete the review of systems, the higher level of care you can bill. So risk assessment can fall under review of systems, and then it's a searchable data in an electronic medical record. So, you know, I would assume if that became a measure, then the electronic medical records could then follow through with, you know, making that a data point that is assessed.
Yeah, so. But that's not currently the system in dentistry, though, actually.
They are, because I fill out a review of systems for my dentist when I go to see him.
It's not part of the claim system.
It's not.
It doesn't get into the claim system, right? Yeah.
Well, it's the point about future microphone, please, David.
It's a great point that goes to a future state, because I think that's what this group is all about, is not to say, well, we don't have that now, and I'm not being critical, but is that, well, that's where we want to get. That's where we want to get and learn from our medical colleagues and learn things that are in place that have worked well for a long time and incorporate those things. You know, I look at you, Amit, just in terms of medical records and dental records and the future state of that. Very exciting area of being able to push that frontier.
So any other concepts under the issue of either missing teeth or periodontal disease?
Just kind of touching upon the risk assessment itself, we spoke about caries, we spoke about periodontal disease, and also oral cancers or lesion. You know, root fractures is another big area where, you know, we might also want to kind of, you know, include that concept within the risk assessment side of things.
I'm sorry, say the root fractures?
Root fractures.
Is that different than broken teeth? Do you want to differentiate that somehow? Is it the same thing or different?
Yeah, the broken teeth could be kind of, you know, from an anatomical side of the, you know, view, it could be any of the crown, but especially the root fractures, you know.
Okay.
I don't know if this is applicable, but we should consider the iatrogenic potential causes of some of these issues, such as broken teeth, such as fractured roots, and other things due to the placements of removable or other type of prosthesis. I mean, we do have breakdown and failure that's due to an intervention that was done. So I think we should somehow capture that.
Yeah, kind of more on the lines of what Bob was talking about. When we do the risk assessment, it's like these are all the variables that come in when you assess a particular condition. So I totally agree with what Bob said.
It's maybe a second level. So one idea would be that you would want to have measures of missing teeth, and then a level down for that would be, to the extent that it's doable, measures of the reason the tooth's missing, which is congenitally missing teeth, trauma of iatrogenic. Okay, anything? Oh.
You know, as far as perio is concerned, I wouldn't totally throw away the concept of CPITN. I think in terms of a dental public health program in a health department, say state health department, the use of CPITN can predict the needs of treatment, both in terms of access and extensiveness of treatment that's needed with regards to perio. It's not an epidemiologic tool, obviously, but it is one that can be helpful for state dental directors and other program managers related to dental.
I'm not sure everyone knows what CPITN is.
Could you explain what that is for folks?
It's a community periodontal index of treatment needs. It was developed in Europe.
It's a screening tool for periodontal disease.
No, it's not a screening tool. It's a tool to determine what service needs are needed.
Oh, okay. All right. Anything else in these categories? So let's move to the next one, which is oral lesions, and we've had a number of, this has come up a number of times, and maybe this needs to be broken down in some way, that oral lesions is too broad. So let's have some discussion about that category and what do we want to do with that in terms of calling for measures.
Well, I think that it probably needs to be broken down into screening, you know, doing an exam and screening for these things. And then I think that there needs to be a measure that is for rate of referral or timing of referral, because it's really one thing to identify it and then watch it for 6 months, and then as opposed to identify it, follow up, and then make the appropriate referral. And then I think in risk assessment, I think it has to come back to, you know, what is the reasoning for that? Because HPV is becoming more and more prominent, though not so much in the oral cavity as it is in the oral pharynx. But these patients are under the age of 45. So, you know, they're not your standard person that you're going to see. They don't have tobacco history. Most of them are upper socioeconomic status, and they are not going to be real happy if they sit on an oral cavity lesion for a long time. So I think that, you know, this is a broader thing than just one, you know, is there a mass or not a mass?
Do we have, this is a little outside this, but it's I think it's analogous. Do we have measures that relate to conditions around patients with cleft lip and cleft palate that used to be a healthy people area of focus? And or are we considering that a subset? It's a potential subset within any of the ones we've discussed so far, but are there particular issues that warrant some focus around that as another category?
It is a category. I don't think I pulled it out into this spreadsheet, but it was a...
It's a priority under F, but the priority area is about monitoring and surveillance, so it's more about whether states have monitoring systems, not about the measures per se. So yeah. We weren't actually going to tackle F, but if you think the content of cleft lip should be a separate content area, then we should talk about it. And if it belongs here, then we
you know,
talk
I
about
don't want to infuse that on top of the this particular area of discussion, but
if you want to call that out separately, yeah, we can do that.
Yeah.
Just kind of more on Jim's talk here. Maybe having a concept or a group or a bucket where we would want to tackle congenital anomalies. Maybe that would be one way of looking at some of the areas where we could be developing some measures.
Just an observation about lesions related to papillomaviruses. The way dentists examine patients now for oral cancer is insufficient in terms of the type of cancers that develop from papillomaviruses. I was talking to the oral medicine director at the University of Minnesota, and I said, you know, dentists are going to miss a lot of these new types of cancerous lesions. I said, what they really need are the long mirrors that otolaryngologists use, because you can't see into the pharynx without them.
Asking me a point?
Well, the only reason I mention it is because I think a lot of dentists think they're doing a great job. And, you know, they're missing probably about a third of the tissue that could be cancerous.
Right. I'm not totally sure, though, that at least in the head and neck surgery community, we would hold dental evaluation responsible for oral pharynx cancer. So anything soft palate and back, I would probably say, is probably more on the primary care physician. And neck, mass, and adult is cancer until proven otherwise, but that's not for this discussion. But I think picking up those premalignancies in the oral cavity and, you know, lesions along the teeth that aren't healing and loose teeth that really don't need a root canal, those are the things that probably just, you know, it's more education, but we just need to make it a metric so that people start looking for those things.
I'm sorry, but I have to disagree with you. I don't think that's just the field of otolaryngologists at all.
No, I'm not saying it is, but I don't think...
Microphone, please.
I agree with you. If we could train our dentists as they come out of dental school to do an oral pharyngeal exam, that would be great. But I don't think the expectation is there right now. It would be great to do it.
Oh, I would. I'm with you.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's my expectation.
Absolutely, I disagree. And I think if we want our pediatricians to do sealants, we should definitely have our dentists do an oral pharyngeal exam. It's about a true partnership. I think all these metrics are about measuring how we can move forward so that as really as interprofessionally, we can move the health of the population forward. And so it's about doing better on the provider side and then measuring on the patient side. So, yeah, absolutely. We all need to do better.
So we're trying to come up with sort of concepts, the call for people to develop specific measures in these areas. So I want to see if we can kind of come back to that discussion. So we talked about within the area of oral lesions having specific measures for based on screening results. Rate of referral was a separate item suggested. Risk assessment. Again, there's some things about tobacco use later on, but there's other risk factors that maybe haven't been called out so that people could develop measures based on other risk factors. And we had a suggestion about developmental anomalies, including cleft palate, which may or not exactly fit under oral lesions. That any other thoughts about other things that should that could be calls for people to develop measures in this area?
I want to ask Amy a question. This is your specialty, and so a couple important things we want to get out of this are, you know, where is there a good evidence base, and are there guidelines? And so to you, in these areas, are there both? And then we didn't find any, in our general scan, find any specific measures being utilized, but do you know of any that we missed that we could include?
Right. So the evidence is one step beyond this, which is after identification, then what do you do with it? So appropriate staging, documented on the chart, multidisciplinary workup, whatever. So but I envision that this group is looking for the step right before that. There, I found a Cochrane review I'll send to you that I thought might be reasonable to at least start with. But you're right. There is no good evidence because nobody's really writing papers about this. Clearly, there's good evidence about the rate of progression from a white lesion to cancer, but, again, not really the evidence you probably want for this, but I can do it.
But are there guidelines in the for the specialty groups for this? No.
For appropriate screening for oral cavity? Yes.
Okay.
But I don't know where they are. So okay. I can get them to you. Yeah.
Well, and I was just going to raise a question. I mean, I don't know the literature well, but I mean, there definitely are some, papers in the literature about screening mechanisms, brush biopsies, I mean, different sort of things like that. So that would be the performance piece that I think, you know, that would be the question is there some sort of a standard that people should be held to, you know, that's generally accepted and has some evidence?
Right. So I think that's the problem is the level of evidence is sort of, I won't say case series, but certainly small series and individual patient population. So nobody's going to say that it's level one randomized controlled studies, which is what we try to hold ourselves to. And then also the techniques involved with brush biopsies and then the fluorescence and whatever. It's very technology heavy, and you either have that in your office or you don't. So it's whether it works enough to say that every provider should be investing in this. It's just the evidence isn't really out there. But there are some nice papers out there, and so we might want to look into something like that.
Bob, and then just before you comment, I just want to let you know, to keep us on track, we've got about 5 minutes left in this.
One of the things we should consider on the oral lesion, too, is as we look at risk factors, we need to consider self-mutilation or any things that the individual might be doing that might be inducing some of the problems they're seeing. Some of the lesions might actually be instrumental or other chewing-related or other categories. It could also fit into socioeconomic status and certain cultural characteristics or habits that certain individuals or subgroups of individuals tend to have. So I just want to make sure we broaden this enough to include some of those other areas that are not so distinctly just pathological.
Great. And anything else in oral lesions? All right. Ahead of the 5 minutes.
Excellent. Well done.
4 extra minutes in the bank for something else. So should we just move right into priority C? So now we've been talking about oral health up till now, sort of characteristics of the patient, what's going on in their mouth. Now we're talking about oral health care, so that shifts it. So the first bucket at the bottom of page 2 was a whole bunch of things that had to do with patient satisfaction. So I kind of listed, I think, I'm not sure I got everyone, but listed most of the patient satisfaction measures that were there. And just before we talk about the first one at the bottom of page 2, also notice the one on the bottom of top of page 3. So on page 2 are measures of patient satisfaction with the care they're receiving. Page 3, I tried to break it out of their satisfaction with their health plan. So the different concepts, actually. So I think what we'd be saying here is, again, that the framework is a call for people to develop measures related to patient satisfaction that could be submitted to NQF or others, and a whole list of possible subtopics for that, and then related to their satisfaction with their health plan. So any discussion about these concepts?
Mary Alice?
I think there's a big omission here in terms of any measurement of dental health insurance coverage. Access to care that is afforded by health insurance is one aspect of quality that needs to be measured. And there, I didn't see anything in this entire pack.
So I want to see if you say a little bit more about that. And on page 2, it does at least reference the idea of developing measures about people's satisfaction with sources of care. Is that different than what you're saying?
Yeah, you don't have a source of care if you can't pay for it.
Okay, so you're talking
about... If you don't have a provider that's willing to see you because you're uninsured or because you're on Medicaid, or if you have Medicare and no coverage.
Yeah, Paul, if I could just chime in there. I think that, I mean, just the term patient satisfaction, I know, you know, the folks that did the CAPS development definitely wanted to get sort of beyond that notion because, I mean, the fact that you're, you know, that you're not getting measured, or the notion that you wouldn't be measured until you become a patient is a limiting issue. But it is possible to certainly identify and survey members of plans or members of that have coverage. So that's sort of one additional category that gets you beyond the users of care. And then I guess the broader question Mary Alice is raising is a way also to examine individuals who don't even have coverage currently, which for the United States is have a population.
Right. The one other point I'd like to make with that is that lapses in care are significant. I don't know how we can measure those. One aspect of the Diamante driver story is that his Medicaid coverage lapsed.
Lapses in coverage, not care, necessarily.
Lapses in coverage, yeah. Right. And this is very, very common in Medicaid and CHIP. That's why you can't have a two-year period look back. And then underinsurance with respect to dental coverage is also a huge problem for people, so that even those who have dental care can't afford to go in with the amount of cost sharing that they have. So to begin with, just measuring satisfaction with the care that people are getting who have access to care, to me, misses a big part of what state and federal government entities would want to know.
Michael? Yeah, I just wanted to comment that large groups of the population aren't able to self-report their satisfaction, namely vulnerable, either children or adults, who are not able to make those assessments on themselves. So whether they access care at all is actually driven by a parent or a care responsible party or guardian, that sort of thing. And I think it gets into the question of we usually call it access because we have sort of a dentist office-centric look at oral health. We think that oral health happens in a dental office, and so, you know, if you access the dental office, you're getting oral health. But a lot of people, you know, don't get to the dental office, and they would actually need either a proactive dental delivery system that would get to them or would need their representatives to be able to be proactive on their part. So I think that's a big part of the access issue, is people who either are vulnerable in the sense that they literally don't have the mental or physical capacity to proactively go and get into a dental system, or they're in a situation where the people that are acting on their behalf aren't doing that. So I don't know how to measure that.
Well,
but
so
I
maybe
think
what we're talking about here is that in pulling from what was in there, they were mostly measures of patient satisfaction, either with the care they're receiving or with their dental plan. But what I think we're talking about here is calling for development of measures of barriers to health, barriers to care. I'm not sure what the last half of that sentence is, but the accessing calling for measures about barriers would sort of get at this issue. We're not just talking about patients who are getting care, and we're not necessarily talking about whether it's the patient. The different data sources could be the patient, it could be caregivers, it could be other things. All would contribute to barriers.
Right, Paul, and I think the distinction you made between, you know, looking at the experience or the level of satisfaction with sort of the clinical aspects of care or the care that occurred, you know, within some sort of provider context,
right,
as opposed to looking at plan issues or, you know, that could be program issues or whatever. Certainly the CAHPS, you know, approach definitely picked up on that a long time ago. And so I think that is a useful way of gathering some information about the fact that, yeah, you have coverage, but it really isn't sort of addressing your barriers.
The responses to a question on unmet need, for example, are going to be hugely different if a person is insured or not, if the person's in Medicaid or not. And then you can also get down to the questions about transportation or lack of willing providers or my mother didn't take me or, you know, whatever else it is that resulted in this unmet need. But I think measuring uninsurance and underinsurance is really important.
I think it comes down to two things. It's not insurance, it's a benefit. Because it's like medical insurance, but you're really insured for catastrophes. Dental insurance is a misnomer. And then second, I think, with the whole access issue, maybe thinking about measuring the number of dentists per population might get to if there is really good coverage, because it's really out in those very rural areas where there are not enough dentists for the populations. Plus, there might be just really access issues from a standpoint of distance as well as issues of do you have a car, as well as do you have people to drive you? So those might be different kind of epidemiological measures to get added versus the satisfaction measures.
Well, and then the other thing is the insured versus the uninsured, the time of treatment is going to be very different, too, because the uninsured are going to need to seek out a very small population of dental providers that have a huge waiting list. And while they're going to get much lower cost for care, they may have to wait a year to get it, whereas someone who can pay or has insurance will be in there and out of there in 30 days. You know, so it's you have to caution yourself when you look at insured versus the uninsured for that reason as well.
So I think what we're saying is that some of these things could be combined together. So unmet needs, availability of sources of care could be combined with measures of have insurance, don't have insurance, where you live, rural, urban, a lot of things could be combined to get measures. But the bigger concepts would be whether you do you have barriers, do you have unmet need, do you is care available, and then you could look at a lot of ways of combining those things.
Also, in all our discussions, we're seemingly talking about individuals who have no physical challenges, mental challenges, or chronic illnesses in terms of individuals with special health care needs. Because one of the things that I had is a situation where I had a mother with a child who had significant cerebral palsy and was home cared. Fortunately for the child, but had tried for 11 years to try and access oral health care and wasn't able to do so. And it was a combination of a physical barrier, and it was also, again, a resource. Who was going to take the insurance this child had, and it bounced between two.
Michael? And I don't know exactly how to broach the subject, but I think most people know that adults in most states do not have much Medicaid coverage whatsoever. And then in states that do, they have, like in Minnesota, we now have a limited adult benefit set, which doesn't include any benefits related to periodontal disease, for example, at all. And so what about the quality implications of having a vulnerable adult, say with special needs or elderly vulnerable adult, whose only health benefit doesn't include coverage for major conditions in the mouth? And I don't know where you go with that, but it seems to me that's a huge barrier to both access and quality, because if you get in and you have a very limited benefit set, the odds are you're going to get what's in your benefit set and not what isn't in it. So your rate of extraction of teeth, for example, may go way up. Et cetera. So I don't know how we broach that. It's a sensitive subject because it's a public-private issue, and there's, you know, it's very complicated. But
that's why I think that's trying to measure if somebody has benefits or not is I don't think a very good measure, because you don't know what's in the benefits.
Correct.
So even with the better benefits plan, it might still not be the same for different people in different populations. So I think it's much better to really try to measure if people get the right care for the right condition and if they have unmet needs or not.
Question. But the U.S. Census Bureau conducts two major nationwide surveys a year measuring whether people have medical insurance or not, and they don't assess what the benefit package is in there. But we don't even have the answer to the question of who has dental insurance as well. So I think asking the question, you know, whether or not it's a comprehensive plan, you know, that's another for another day. But even asking the basic question, I think, is really important.
And I asked for clarification because I thought one of the charges we had with this group was to make a recommendation as to what we said minimum standards should be. And so I come from a state which has no adult dental. They've eliminated it. And so the charge should be to be able to go back and say, if the recommendation is you have this, then there's some grounds for arguing to the fact you don't have the right to eliminate this, because we have set a standard of quality that this needs to be provided. And I know that's a little bit of a political issue as well, but that's what I thought we were trying to do. And if we're saying the minimum requirements are that you have this and this, it's prevention, to include some minimal for restorative, and you're right, it's not going to cover everything, we know that. But
so
that's
let's
what
see
I
if we can get
we
some clarification on that, because I don't think that that's the charge of this group, is to develop standards. I think we're talking about potential things that could be measured sort of at the concept level, which is different than
what the answer should be once you measure it.
I mean, I think it's, you know, well beyond. I mean, having decent measures could help to make the case for that, but that's going to be dealt with through some combination of the Surgeon General and the Institute of Medicine and Congress and
state. I have to say, I totally agree with the sentiment. I would love to be able to have this group bang the gavel and say every state has to have adult benefits.
Yeah. Let it be done.
You know, the difficulty with that entire issue is when you try to measure whatever you want to measure, in populations that have various benefit structures, you're going to get different answers, and the epidemiology of people might be the same. For example, in Minnesota, there has been a downgrading of the adult dental benefit, but EPSDT kids still get everything. Pregnant women get scaling and root planing. Some outpatient centers can have covered people get scaling and root planing. And even within the government programs, there's a lot of variations. And that really affects, as you know, the dentist will tell you when you call them, well, you didn't pay for such and such. So, you know, the patient just can't get it. And then you tell them, well, are you treating the patient or are you treating the insurance company? And so there's a feeling among the dentists that the only, for practical reasons, the only things patients will get are those that are paid for either under commercial product or government programs product. And so I guess the point is that studying these things, given the different benefit structures, will definitely give you different answers.
But having the information about who has health insurance or not, at the national level, at the state level, at the community level now from the ACS, is a very powerful advocacy tool. And we don't even have that basic information about dental care, never mind the variation in the packages. And so I think just having the data available, adding a question to the CPS or to the ACS would be worthwhile.
So I'm trying to just summarize these things as people are talking. Let me just throw out what I'm hearing here and hope I haven't missed something important. But I think what I'm hearing is four big concepts related to this area. One is satisfaction with care that people actually have received. One is satisfaction with the health plan. Third one is barriers to care. And fourth one is unmet need. And then all of these things being potentially stratified by whether you're insured or not, the level of coverage, lapses in coverage, health conditions that you have, disabilities, other kind of things that might affect your either actual use of services or your feelings about them, would all be sort of ways of stratifying those four basic concepts.
Yeah, well, and I think it's obvious, but, you know, even with and then getting down to actual plan level as well, because, you know, certainly within a state Medicaid program for kids, you can see considerable variation by plan. And, you know, and I think some states over time have acted upon that and gotten rid of some plans. But, I mean, yeah, yeah, exactly. But, I mean, it's, you know, it starts with measurement.
On a state level, though, I believe, like in my own state, we do a family and household survey, which is done by the Policy Center, Dr. Damiano. Many of the questions that we talked about, level of coverage, ratio between medical and health, satisfaction rates, and so forth, and timeliness of care are answered. I mean, those are, at least for the population, for the, we're talking about really Title V and the children population of that, but it's a pretty broad survey. It's a phone survey. So I think other states probably are doing similar things.
I think it's significant variation. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You're one end of the spectrum, probably. Dick.
I certainly think that Mary Alice is right in saying on a large population basis, for example, a national population study, or even multi-state study or regional study, that there's no doubt that the fact that people who have dental insurance seek treatment and get much more treatment than others, But the only reason I brought that up is because it's much more complex than that. I mean, and some of you have mentioned it, the complexity of this issue is much more difficult to assess and utilize than just a broad-based look at that situation.
Agreed. And I think we're about to move into another area which gets even more complex, which is, that wasn't difficult enough, because we've been talking about sort of satisfaction measures. But the next grouping of things, they're sort of loosely related together. We're on page 3, so we've talked about, the top one was about dental plans, and we've made some modifications of that. But then we get into a whole bunch of things related to oral health services provided by non-dental provider, by a non-dentist provider. I use those are my terms. And what I meant by that is, a non-dental provider is someone who's not an oral health care professional. A non-dentist provider could be, like a dental hygienist or a dental assistant, could be a non-dentist, but maybe could be an oral health care provider. There's things about referrals and visits with dentists. There was stuff about daily mouth care by caregivers, provider availability, continuous sources of care. So a whole bunch of things that are sort of loose. It was hard to actually lump them together because they're all related but different enough. I had trouble lumping them together. So maybe just think about, are there some big concepts here that again, could be called for measurement areas, or do we just need to talk about each one individually? I'm not sure. So.
Mary Alice?
I just wondered, when I saw the measures that specified non-dental provider or non-dentist provider, that I thought to myself, why wouldn't you measure it for everybody and then ask a second question, who provided the care?
So those,
because you also want to know what subset of all the services being given or the people being served are being served by dentists versus allied dental professionals versus non-dental providers.
So you're suggesting those things could actually be just part of the stratification of answers to other questions. So.
Let's see.
Bob? One thing you are missing here is the availability of care coordination. And I think, you know, some states are implementing various care coordination models that link health and primary care with dental so that it facilitates patients finding resources for care. And that's been very successful in some states. And so I think we should at least have a category where we capture the availability or lack thereof, because that may have a big variation on how many are getting. For example, the Medicaid population in one state may be getting a greater level of care, even though they have similar programs, because there's another variable that's kind of accelerating that excess. So I think we need to consider that too.
Bob, I think that's a very good point. In fact, Delta Dental of Minnesota has a care coordination plan for the SCHIP and the Medicaid and other programs, and it works very well, at least in terms of getting non-institutionalized people care. The other thing I wanted to mention was that the issue of people other than dentists but who are dentally trained is very important. In Minnesota, we have two different, for practical purposes, I'll call them dental nurses. We have a dental nurse light program and a dental service heavy program. And it's obvious that the dental service light program is almost useless, and the dental service heavy program will really help in increasing access to care.
Okay.
Paul, this, you know, just I happen to see, you know, you got daily mouth care by caregiver in here. And I think, you know, from a performance measurement standpoint, I think that is probably only going to apply where there's a requirement that actually be done. I mean, I don't know how we're going to get into figuring out whether parents are monitored.
It actually came from the nursing home section.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Yeah.
Michael, you might want to comment on that.
Yeah, I can comment on that a little bit. In both long-term care and group home settings, where you have people who are presumably permanently disabled and presumably lifelong Medicaid and as they get older, Medicare recipients, there are requirements around that. And it's really in terms of who's going to be stable orally and who isn't, this is it.
Anybody else?
Just one other thing I thought of with respect to the oral health screenings provided by non-dental providers. In Connecticut, for example, our Medicaid program reimburses for that service when it's provided by pediatricians, but only for children under three. So the measure is going to need to be stratified by some other factors, too.
Right. Yeah. That varies by state. There's
But see, I want to get back to your point. I think we focus on what, you know, what's important to provide, what's important to receive as a patient, and much less on who's providing it. Because we're in the midst of a huge change in what and who's going to provide care to dental care, and who is also going to be involved in oral health care, physicians, et cetera. So I think your first point I agree completely with. Focus on what needs to be provided, and then, you know, not make assumptions about quality based on who's providing it, but maybe just track who's providing it.
So I wonder how that discussion relates to the measure here about the receipt of referrals and visits with the dentist. There's a lot of measures about utilization of services. I mean, the one that's the most cross-cutting across any measurement system is dental visits. Now that would seem to be different than, you know, did they get the need, what was needed? Dental visit may or may not be a measure of that. I wonder, how do you all feel about the measures? It comes up in a couple of places about referrals and visits with dentists. Is that something we need to call for more development?
I would say yes. Well, I mean, again, couldn't get into the details, but, you know, I certainly heard Alan Finkelstein, when he was with United Healthcare, talk about a program they implemented in New Jersey where they not only looked at, you know, whether kids were getting services in primary care offices, whether they were getting assessments and things that they paid for, but they actually looked at the connection then, whether those kids ended up in dental plans and set up, dental providers,
incentivize it,
right. So
yeah.
I think, you know, more of those things, and again, it ought to be benchmarked against whatever guidelines, you know, periodicity schedules, whatever, say is the appropriate sort of approach to care. But I think, you know, actually tracking some of those things, because I agree. I mean, I think we ought to track where the services occur, and evidence over time will tell us whether that's efficient and effective or not, or whether or not that's just duplication and one's better than the other.
Elspeth, you were about to comment.
Yeah, having actually spent the early part of my career in geriatric care, the measure that I didn't see in here reminds me of what you thought about in the failure to thrive in the pediatric population. It's a simple measure of, can the elderly population eat? Do they have dentures? Do they have dentures that fit? Do they have teeth that they can chew with? Are they losing weight? You know, that very practical measures that when I worked in the nursing home industry, a lot of elderly people just didn't do well because they didn't have teeth or they didn't have teeth that worked.
So that's activities of daily living kind
yeah,
of
more along, yeah, more along those things. And yes, it's important that they do get twice a day oral care if they cannot do it themselves, but if they only get it from their upper denture because they don't have a lower denture and they're still gumming, you know, a little bit of their mashed potatoes, that's not getting the nutrition that they need. And that's was kind of...
So we did, a little while ago, did talk about specifically the measure we pulled out of the longer list, which is ability to chew and or discomfort chewing. That we have gotten agreed. I think we've agreed to include that one already. So does that get at what you were talking about? Okay.
Mary Alice, you wanted to say something?
I come from using claims data to try and track services, and so measures like advising about tooth decay, receipt of referral, and dental counseling in the medical setting, those are aspects of the quality of care that don't typically generate a claim. And so tracking the information on a population basis is really, really difficult. And intense, resource-intensive.
Yeah, the assessing, at least for those states that, for most of the states that pay non-dentists to do that, there is some requirement of documentation that the service be provided. So in that case, there would be. Now, the referral doesn't necessarily generate a claim because there's no payment for the actual referral. But in the case of the assessment, in order to get the payment from the Medicaid managed care system or from the, well, from Medicaid, one has to document that in their. Yeah, that's correct.
I've been about food today and
will be found in a chart review, but not found in claims data. So feasibility was on my mind when I was looking at those.
But the claim in different states, the requirement for submitting a code may include all those things, or it may
that's
not.
Right. And that's right.
That's where it has to get down to the left.
And we're running into that with survivorship's a big push at the Institute of Medicine right now, making sure that people who survive their cancer get into routine follow-up, which includes appropriate screening. And we found that if you just look at the people that go to the survivorship appointments, that you're missing a large portion of the population, because you can advise someone to do it, but whether they do it or not is not really there. And the measure you actually want to measure is whether or not you're advising them. It's not how many people actually follow your advice, which in cancer is huge. So we've started looking at putting into the medical record a data point, a checkbox, you know, because we're electronic, a checkbox that can then be searched for that says that you did advise the patient about survivorship, and it's in like the assessment and plan of the medical record. And maybe that's what you're looking for here, is in the dental record having a data point, a checkbox that says we did discuss oral prevention, or you know, whatever they are, caries prevention and whatever. And then that can be, yes, you have to search the medical record, but if it's a checkbox, then it's a data point as opposed to reading the assessment and plan of whatever a busy a dentist and provider.
Can I be, I'm going to be a little controversial here in saying that, I mean, I'm not so sure it's all that important to track, you know, education efforts with patients, because frankly, most research indicates they don't work. And, you know, most of what we do when we talk to patients doesn't result in any change in behavior and any positive result in their oral health. So, I mean, I think if we're going to waste, you know, spend effort tracking things, we should track things that have some hope, some evidence of showing they're going to improve somebody's oral health. And right now, the way we do patient education, the way we were all taught and are still taught in dental schools, doesn't work.
Just to kind of add to that, but, you know, when a medical provider provides a certain amount of education, that has a much more impact on the patient, you know, and especially if the medical provider is talking about the oral health related, maybe there is a point to kind of, you know, track that and make sure whether did the referral go through. So there are like two aspects. One, the oral, the education component, the patient education component itself coming from a medical provider, and maybe even stratifying it based on the specialty of the medical provider, and also looking at the, you know, the referrals that are being made. I mean, obviously there are challenges when we look at the different states, you know, how much of that information is actually going into the medical record? Is that available? You know, how much of it could come through claims? Those are some of the current issues. But, you know, as a group, when we sit here, maybe those are a couple of things that we might want to kind of, you know, start developing or at least recommending.
So I just have one pertinent thing to say about referrals. I'm working on a project right now where there's a couple different organizations working looking at how EPSDT information is captured in the CMS 416 form. One of the things that's in there is a measure on referrals, and the latest word from the group that's working on that is that the quality of information that's available to Medicaid right now is approaching useless.